We start today's BP Art or GBH studio at the Boston Public Library with one of the most harrowing survival tales ever in Ruthless River. The two locals who experienced it, they join us. Then, while you watch the congressional baseball game, is healthcare being repealed? An attack on North Korea being planned? We'll talk about just too much going on. Followed by Emily Rooney on Megyn Kelly meets lunatic Alex Jones, plus our list of fixations and fulminations. And at noon, just after the judge hands down the decision in the Michelle Carter texting suicide case, we'll discuss it with you.
Judd Apatow, the man who gave us Bridesmaids, Knocked Up, Trainwreck, Girls, and so much more on his new movie, plus his upcoming stand-up gig right here at the Wilbur Theater. Boston Globe columnist Shirley Young tells us why we might rethink shopping at TJ Maxx and what it means that Amazon is buying Whole Foods. Wow, will Jim soon be banned from the hot bar? Callie Crossy on the Bill Cosby trial, all that coming up.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. And because it's Friday, we are broadcasting live from our beautiful studio here at the WGBH, at the Boston Public Library, corner of Exeter and Boylston Street. Hello, Jim.
Beautifully put, Marjorie. Nice to see you. So this is an incredible day. The Michelle Carter decision is going to come down any minute. Donald Trump admits he is under investigation in a tweet that's even odd for Donald Trump. Jeff Bezos is buying Whole Foods. We're going to get to all of those things in a couple of minutes. But, you know, normally when two people get married, they vow to be with each other for better or for worse. In the case of the newlywedded Holly and Jerry Fitzgerald, worse meant a plane crash in Bolivia, being adrift in waters swarming with piranhas and giant armored South American alligators, fighting off swarms of fire ants, and being near starvation. It's all in Holly Fitzgerald's great new book. It's called Ruthless River, Love and Survival by Raft on the Amazon's Relentless Madre de Dios. Holly and Jerry Fitzgerald, it's great to have you both here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Great.
Were you her boss, by the way, at some point before
yes,
we got to
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
How was she as an employee?
She was wonderful.
I've got to say it again. Your mic wasn't on. She was what?
She was wonderful.
Yeah, okay,
that's
fine.
That's right. I was wonderful. He was a city editor, managing editor a million years ago when we were both at the Standard Times in New Bedford, where, by the way, I did not know until I read this book, I just said this to you, that I knew you were in Vietnam. I didn't know you were wounded twice in Vietnam. And I never heard this story. You know, I'm working with a man here who gets hysterical if he's got 2% milk instead of whole milk or 1% milk or whatever it is.
That's true.
In his cafe latte. And then I finished this book last night. This is an incredible read, and I can't believe that you, frankly, got out of there because you were there for a very long time. But tell people, and Holly wrote this book, tell people what happened. Jim just referred to your honeymoon. This was like a wedding trip kind of deal, Holly?
Well, we didn't really decide on it until about a year after we were married, and we thought, well, we don't have any commitments, and at this time, why don't we save up, and we work different jobs, and about a year later, we took off. So it was a honeymoon, but it was a late honeymoon.
Yes.
And so it was like two hippies, kind of. I mean, it was a hippie thing, right?
It was kind of back in that era.
And for the first few months of this, Jerry, this was almost the honeymoon from heaven, right? I mean, it was a pretty beautiful experience, yes?
It was, except for the very first day we landed at a godforsaken place called Barranquilla, and there were all open sewers, and guys with Tommy guns in the doorways of every store, and I just looked at this and I thought to myself, right, we got this for another year. This is like but actually it was idyllic. We got to go places that, frankly, a lot of places that weren't in the guidebooks at all. We were very fortunate. We met many families who invited us in, kind of thing.
And that lasted for months, correct?
About 5 months before we took the raft.
Yeah, and before you even took the raft, things went awry initially when you were in a plane and it crashed.
That's right. That's when things really started going off the tracks.
Yes.
We were at a good itinerary before that, and then we were on our way to a tributary, and the plane crashed down. Well, it was a crash landing into a penal colony, which we didn't realize it was a penal colony at the time. But as we were trooping up this little path, we met this man who had a you know, he was on the side with his machete, and he offered to help us carry our bags. And we were talking in Spanish with him, and we said, where are we? And finally, we're looking up in our dictionary, what does he mean, what does he mean? And it turned out he had shot his sister with 7 arrows. We're looking back and forth and saying, this can't be. And when we finally got to the end of the path, it turned out a big sign saying the penal colony, Peruvian penal colony, where all the worst murderers and rapists are put, because there's no way out. There are no fences, no walls. It's just the jungle. Will
okay.
kill you.
So then you decided it was going to take you, 3 months or something before there was going to be an opportunity to get out of here. So you came up with this idea that you would do what, Jerry Fitzgerald?
Well, after we got out of the penal colony, that in essence, that delayed us so that we missed our connection. The boat was going across northern Bolivia, and then we were going to take a second boat up to the Amazon. That was the goal. And what happened was the boat left the day before we got there, and there wasn't another one for 3 months or so.
So that was when you decided to go down the Amazon?
Well, a stranger approaches in a kind of a cafe, dirt floor cafe.
This is Juan, yes?
Yes,
this is
Juan. Juan. His name is Juan.
Yeah, and who spoke excellent English, and unbeknownst to us, had been listening to us griping back and forth, saying, what the heck are we going to do now, and this kind of thing. And he said, well, you know, we don't really get many boats down here. People use rafts.
And he suggested you construct one, correct? Was that
yes.
not it?
Yeah, you construct one, or really, you don't even have to construct it. We had a pretty good-sized raft that was actually half of an even larger one, but we could not in any way control the really big one, so we made it a smaller one. And
as Jim said in the opening, going down, you were talking about these caimans, like these 15-foot, like, alligators were in this river, and there were... eels and piranhas and snakes and all this kind of thing, but you thought it was a good idea to go down this river in this raft and hope that none of these wild animals got you. So it went okay in the raft for a little bit, but then what happened?
Well, we did. We just loved it for the first few days. It was just bliss. It was like being out there, Huck Finn, and suddenly this big storm came up, but that was 4 days and 4 nights into it. So it was in the night, and the big storm came up, and a big trunk of a tree crashed into our tent, which was a plastic, very strong plastic. So once that happened, we were thrown off, and we tried to get the trunk off the tree, off the raft, but we'd been thrown off. We didn't realize that night.
And what's your state of mind? You know, you're so blithely describing, we land in a penal colony with murderers
plane
and
crashes.
Rapists. The plane crashes, but then we had 4 great days on the river. What was your state of mind after having lived through just the beginning of this, and we haven't gotten to the worst to some degree? What was your state of mind at this point?
Well, you know...
We were young.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was young, too. Believe me, I'm not doing this.
We were in our 20s.
Look, we were in our 20s, and Holly had grown up in a family that traveled. You know, she'd been to Guatemala, she'd been to Israel, she'd been to Europe and Mexico and all that stuff. I had spent an afternoon at Niagara Falls and a tour in Vietnam. And, you know, so I was pretty much following Holly. You know, I'm 26 years old.
Maybe not madly, a good idea.
Madly in love with a beautiful girl who... suggests that we build a raft and go down the Madre de Dios and.
Okay, well, I didn't mean to interrupt. So, okay, the raft is struck by this tree, and obviously that's the end of that thing. Tell us, Holly, what's the next round of this tour?
Well, then it did start to be more terrifying, because the next morning we thought we'd be on our way, and it was only really one day until we were going to get to River Alta, our destination. We'd go on 4, and if we went night and day, the 5th day, we'd get there. So we suddenly realized that the current was really, really slow.
We were off the river.
Yeah,
we were on a dead-end channel.
It took us a while, though. That day, we didn't quite believe it, because Juan had told us there's no chance
no problem.
We could go off.
Yeah, no problem.
No problem. So we didn't know. We hadn't seen maps where there were these detours that never returned to the actual river. So,
were there any people?
No people.
Human beings,
and
none.
All water. It was water.
No
it was
land.
The flood season, so no land at all. Otherwise, maybe we could have tried to walk out. But because the water went way deep in, to the forest, we really only had the raft to be on.
And you talk about that there were kind of like these stages of survival. I think you had the action stage when you're going to, like, you know, mm-hmm. take action, get out of there. Then the meditation and acceptance that you're stranded stage. Then the praying to God stage and the frantically looking for food stage. So at the beginning, you thought, you know, that you could handle this. And I think what happened is we went on another raft, found another raft, and went down there for hours and found out you weren't really very far from the first raft that was stranded.
Yeah, well, I don't think we ever thought that we could handle it particularly. I was certainly frightened from moment one as soon as I realized that there was a dead end river. This is a picture of an oxbow that isn't yet fully formed.
Yeah.
It goes miles out into the jungle and it hasn't come back to the river, and a raft only goes one way.
Yeah.
You know, and the catch 22 is, A, we had been warned, don't even get into the water, okay? And
why? Because what's in it?
Because there's little fish that will enter orifices in
your
intestines. There are anaconda. There are caiman, which is a type of alligatorish
15
type.
15 feet.
You know, alligatorish
yeah,
type.
15 yeah, 15 feet.
Well,
yeah.
Crocodile, alligator,
yeah.
And
boa constrictors.
Yeah, but you know, it was you didn't want to get in the water. Not to mention the piranha. Obviously, we had eaten piranha from similar waters once with some Indians in Ecuador, so we knew the piranha were there, and they didn't taste that good anyway. But we would have, you know.
And at night, when you were asleep, there were unbelievable sounds of animals.
By the way, if I may interrupt, Michelle Carter is found guilty. We're going to talk to Emily Rooney about it a little bit later.
Wow.
And to Dan Small, former prosecutor and now a noted defense attorney, Michelle Carter, is guilty, I assume, of involuntary manslaughter.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I'm stunned. Wow.
I am too, actually.
Surprised, actually.
Yeah, I am too. But let's get back to this. So, and you would hear these animals in the...
You know, shrieking in the trees and howling and all kinds of sounds.
So you also talk about the things you confronted. The most horrifying to me, beyond the mosquitoes, which is bad enough, I can't even imagine being swarms of mosquitoes, were these swarms of bees that when you would open up your tent. Mm. Tell us about that.
Well, it was like a blanket just sitting on you all day long, and you're very hot anyway. Because it's probably over 100 degrees and the humidity. And so it's so sticky, and every time you move, they sting you. If you just lie completely still, they won't sting you.
But there are hundreds and hundreds,
hundreds
of bees.
Of them on each of us,
On your face and your eyes and your whole body.
Yeah.
And like a blanket.
Yeah.
Yes.
That didn't cause you to have almost a nervous breakdown?
Oh, it was horrible.
Thanks. Yeah.
It was horrible. I mean, and...
It was close.
And then the wasps started building their nest inside the tent and carrying the, you know, what they call the mud wasps, the dogma. They start building, and, you know, it's, as Holly said in the book, the jungle was swallowing us alive, basically.
And you ran out of food.
Oh, we had almost no food to begin with.
So what'd you eat?
Well, then we started looking for things. Once we got to that stage, we had a little bit of cheese in the beginning and a couple of little things. But once we got back, after we were trying to get out, swimming and sleeping in a tree and all that, we started looking, and finally we started seeing a few little things,
like
grubs and little frogs. I think it was starting to be spring. So suddenly we got lucky and we were seeing these things. Now, going out looking for those things probably took as much energy as... if we just laid there and not eaten it. But who knows? It gave us, you know, we were being proactive still.
And how long in between sightings of a human being? How many days did you go without seeing another human?
Well, we were trapped in there 26 days, and then we'd been on the raft 31, all total 31.
So essentially virtually a month.
Yes.
When there was a point at which I assume one or both of you decided we're not ever... coming home. Was there not? I mean, I read that you each said each of you shored up the other when your spirit got low, but that only goes so far when you're in this unbelievable... So were there points when you said, I'm dead, he's dead? Were there or no? You're shaking your head. You thought you were going to get out of this?
We weren't giving up.
That was the thing. But, you know, we were just going to keep going as best we could. And
the worst thing would have been if one of us had died. that would have been just horrendous.
Right. Well, but you were almost dead. I mean, after you were rescued, which we'll get to in a second, I mean, you were a day or two from starving to death.
Well, I was, and she was in better shape than I was.
Oh, really? But, why do you think that was? You're a woman?
Well, I
wonder. Didn't smoke as much, maybe?
I don't know. It's a question. Nobody can really answer.
Yeah.
It might be a woman. I was, you know, smaller. Mm-hmm. Maybe I didn't eat as much, and we weren't eating much but these couple of slugs anyway. So he was a tall guy, and I don't know.
I had some kind of awful, not to bring up the subject, but awful parasite or something. And I couldn't quite understand this because I said to the doctor, Holly's drinking the same water I'm drinking. You know, and it was the kind of thing you had to drink it through closed teeth because you had to wipe the muck off your teeth, but you had to have water. And he said, the doctor said, well, maybe you've been carrying that since Vietnam, which I thought was... that didn't occur to me, but on the other hand, why did she not have it? I don't understand.
And a couple of times you saw planes go by, and they didn't see you.
That was so frustrating.
And one of the things I think must have been so frustrating, you would see these fish in the water, but you couldn't catch the fish. So you're eating baby birds and tiny frogs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So tell us about how you were rescued.
Should we tell that?
Oh, you don't want to give it away. Oh.
Okay,
well,
I don't give it away.
Fine,
I don't give it away.
No,
I won't
but I have
give
a couple
away.
Of questions
Except
about
you guys.
The,
incredibly
no,
luck.
Good.
Yeah,
actually, read
luck.
The book. It's called Ruthless River: Love and Survival by Raft on the Amazon's Relentless Madre de Dios. How hard is this to tell the story? Well, first of all, how hard was it to write the story? I know you kept a journal, Holly.
Yeah.
And Jerry, for you, how hard is it to even tell the story? You know, we're making light of some part of it. This is about as terrifying
as
it can get. Yeah. How hard was it to relive it through the writing, Holly?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, a lot of times I just did the lighter parts first. That's why maybe it doesn't seem light probably to you, but it was lighter, the parts, even up to the penal colony because, you know, we were okay. But the other
Nothing
part,
like a good plane crash for a laugh, I'll
well,
tell you. That's
you
my
make,
attitude.
Right, when you make it, and nobody was really hurt, just one
And did you not
ankle.
Participate? I mean, you're a journalist in your former life. Did you not co-write this because
you didn't
want to live with it?
No. I had intended to write this years and years ago. I got about 100 pages of, I thought, pretty bad typescript. And I said to Holly, I can't do this. This creeps me out. I'm not going to do this. And so I didn't even enjoy reading it, you know, frankly. I mean, I think everybody else seems to, but
how does it feel now, 50 decades removed?
Yeah, creepy.
How does it, still?
Yeah.
For you too, Holly?
No, for some reason it doesn't affect me the
but
same
you,
way.
But so you decided, now you retired, you were a social worker, you retired, and then you went to a memoir class and decided that you were going to pursue this.
Yes, well, my daughter saw this, Megan saw some little brochure, and it said memoir, and she said, why don't you take this? And I said, well, I'm not really interested right now, but it was only 4 weeks and 2 hours a week, and little did I know I would end up, you know, carrying on, and a lot of it was fun. I mean, working with the words and changing the words around. I had been an English major, so
I know you're
I
big travelers, like you two. Did you ever go back to this part of the world?
No.
Would you go back to this part of the world?
I don't know. That's what the publishers said, but I don't think we're not ready
South
for that.
South America is a wonderful, wonderful place. This particular... You know, it's interesting because Holly, I think Marjorie was at Booksmith the other night in Brookline.
Yes, I was.
She kicked this off, and Holly said something about, well, you know, I love the jungle, and all I can think of was, I don't love the jungle. I didn't love the jungle back then. I don't want anything to do with the jungle, frankly. But, you know, I'm jungled out, you know?
Yeah. And, I know. We did go to Belize. I had no idea.
She took me to Belize, and it was like, oh, my
poor
God.
Poor guy. You know, okay,
and,
this is it.
You know,
right?
It is very hard, and, you know, I'm very proud of Holly. I mean, this is a situation where she was an English major, but she was not, a practice writer. And she wrote... very, very well done book, Ruthless River, and we're getting very good reviews and a lot of great feedback. And, you know, she finished writing this book at 70 years old. and she just sent it off to New York to an agent who took it and then sold it to Random House. So it's almost like...
It was meant to be told.
It's crazy. That doesn't happen.
You know why? Because it's one of the greatest stories I've ever read of people surviving for a month in the jungle and being close to death and being... You know, one last thing before you guys go. You hear all the time that if you have one of these experiences that your whole life has changed, you have an appreciation of the sunset and the sunrise and enjoy every single second. If that happened at all, how long did it last?
Well, maybe to the airport. No, longer than that. But, okay. You know, we were certainly thrilled to see our family.
And it's also a great love story. Yeah. Very great love story and romance.
So Holly, it's
a wonderful book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Both
you.
Of you for being
Thank
here.
You for
Holly Fitzgerald's book is Ruthless River, Love and Survival by Raft on the Amazon's Relentless... I'm going to mispronounce this.
Madre de Dios.
Madre de Dios. Thank you very much.
Marjorie,
Holly Fitzgerald and her husband.
You think I would have survived?
No, I do not, Jim.
I
would have either.
Neither do I.
And Jerry Fitzgerald, my old boss, great to talk to you both. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Up next, we're opening the lines up and asking you about everything, basically. In a week that was a conveyor belt of breaking news going at warp speed, what's the headline you've been most focusing on? Are you keeping up with Alex and Mother Jones's, or are you turning it out? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Before we get to the topic at hand, we mentioned to you that the judge, remember, no jury in the Michelle Carter case, found her guilty. The state asked to revoke Carter's bail. The judge denied it. Carter is remaining out on bail for now on probation. Again, we'll discuss it with Emily Rooney in about 15 minutes and with Dan Small, who's a noted former prosecutor and defense lawyer, both in town and across the country. But first, here is just a snapshot of the week that still is.
All right, we have some significant breaking news for you out of North Korea. We have learned that one of the four Americans detained in North Korea, Otto Warmbier, has been released.
Captured on cell phone video, the chilling moment that rapid gunfire broke out in Alexandria this morning.
This building is still on fire, the death toll still rising, dozens still missing, most of them lived on the top floors.
And a UPS employee showed up with two guns for a company meeting and opened fire, killing three, injuring two before being confronted by police and committing suicide.
And President Trump firing back against news that he is now personally the subject of a criminal investigation. The probe, which the president calls a witch hunt, is exploring whether the president has obstructed justice.
You know, of course, we also have Dennis Rodman in North Korea. President Trump's announcement, I think today, that he'll reverse part of Obama's U.S.-Cuba policies. The Senate could pass a health care bill any day. Russia is claiming to have killed the head of ISIS. There are protests in Russia. There are also two high-profile trials. We mentioned Carter. There's Bill Cosby. And along the way, Dutch fishermen discovered a rare two-headed porpoise. Forget that one. We're opening the lines, and we're doing it very briefly at 877-301-8970. Marjorie and I were talking about this. In times like these, focus on the government stuff, I think. How do you stay abreast? We discussed this in January, right after Donald Trump was inaugurated. How do you stay abreast of things that matter in your life? I'm sitting at home last night. I can't believe I'm watching the congressional baseball game on CNN. And then I'm reading at the same time that Jared Kushner is now the subject of the Russia investigation. And then, as I say, is an attack being planned on North Korea because of the prisoner that was released comatose?
I hope not.
What's the impact of the reversal of Barack Obama's policies? Most of them, not all of them. Vis-a-vis Cuba, the health care bill, your buddy from Fall River, E.J. Dion, writes today in the Washington Post, the health care bill could be released out of the Senate any minute.
And
how do you decide to manage your information-consuming life to take in what matters?
Well, you know, you wonder if some of this is the Steve Bannon-esque strategy.
Because, government by chaos.
Yes, exactly. Government by chaos, and keep everybody's eye off the ball while you're doing all these other things behind the scenes. And you pointed out last week that we were all fixated on whatever it was last week while the House undid a lot of the Dodd-Frank reforms. And the healthcare thing is a
Do you remember what you said that morning? And I'm not saying this to embarrass you. you say there's virtual paralysis
nothing is happening.
Oh, other than the fact then, this morning we repealed the most important financial regulation of the last quarter century.
Well, they haven't quite repealed it yet.
The House repealed it.
They've got to get it through the Senate. But, I mean, I think the health care bill, which is going to be a big deal to people, and, you know, if they are going to take away a lot of the Obamacare protections, they're going to do it in a way to try to fool you, to say, well, it's not going to be so bad, and it's going to be down the road, and it's going to try to be they're hoping that people won't notice this, because if they do what they're talking about, it's going to be absolutely draconian.
But don't you think it is conscious? For example, the Cuba thing today. It's just to take this one thing. Why today? I would argue there's a conscious and pretty smart strategy. Let's focus on this. We're still focused on Congressman Scalise, as we should be, who was shot the other day. We're talking about this baseball game, which one thing about this. I don't know if you're watching CNN last night. This is going to sound hard. Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, who hate each other, the Republican and Democratic leaders show up. Mitch McConnell is in a polo shirt, a short, and grandma jeans, which he has clearly never worn before. He is trying to be bipartisan. Then we have Chuck Schumer attempting to make jokes about bipartisanship. It was the most pathetic, forced thing. And then again, as I'm saying to myself, I'm watching this baseball game and listening to these two guys, the health care of 24 million people might disappear. So the question is, how do you manage? How do you deal with all this? How do you consume what you think you need to consume to be an involved member of this changing society?
But here's a good thing. If you are a liberal on immigration laws, that President Trump has apparently now reversed his campaign pledge to get rid of the so-called dreamers, undocumented immigrants who came here as children. So I don't know if he's trying to slip that one under the radar or what, but that's another one of the things that has been done while we've been all focusing on this terrible shooting and on the continued Russia investigation.
Let's go to it. We only have a couple of minutes for some quick calls because Emily's joining us soon. Dave in Boston, you're on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Welcome.
Hey, guys. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi to you.
Yes.
Ooh. Yeah, before this morning, I was interested in the London thing.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter lives by there. But when I woke up this morning and heard that Amazon had bought Whole Foods, that's something that affects my life. I'm just curious to find out what they're going to do different. Are they just buying good companies, or are they going to change the way we shop? Like they've changed the way we buy things that, you know, non-perishable items now. You know, if you want to buy something and you don't have to go shopping, just go
online. Well, can I tell you, Dave, we know nothing, but Shirley Leung, business columnist for the Globe, knows everything, and she's going to be here about 1 o'clock, and she will answer all of your questions about the Amazon, the Jeff Bezos purchase of Whole Foods. So don't go away. Dave, thanks for the call.
Yeah, that is a good one, though. You do think you'd be ordering your groceries online. Of course, you could already do that.
Yeah, but now, it's also, I would say in the grand scheme, I'm concerned about it, too, because I live at the hot bar with a cot, as
it's
you well know.
It's not as big a deal
as
declaring war on North Korea.
By the way, I didn't even mean that. I don't mean that to be provocative. When a man is held prisoner, obviously physically and psychologically abused to the point that he's in a coma. Does a Donald Trump decide that it is both an opportunity or maybe a requirement that I do something? Just like the 59 Tomahawk missiles were to make a statement to Syria, not to change anything. Does he do something vis-a-vis North Korea?
I don't know.
Who has time to think about it?
I don't know, but it would be a wonderful distraction. And I think he knows that his polls keep going down and down and down, his poll numbers, and a military action, unfortunately, from my perspective, tend to increase the popularity of the person that's the aggressor in the military action.
Stephanie in Fall River, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for giving us a call. Hi.
Hi. You mentioned that, you know, where do you go to get some kind of curated news because there's so much of it. I use Twitter. That's where you can follow newspapers.
Yeah, you can.
Networks and journalists. So you're getting the latest breaking information in a very short amount of information. You can click on further links to get it. It's more current than what's happening on television, and it's not a lot of talking heads.
Yeah, but the problem is it's a quarter of an inch deep. It's a quarter of an inch deep. So I agree.
They always provide links to bigger.
No, I understand that, but there are only so many hours in the day. I'm not criticizing you. I am totally where you are. But how do you decide? Well, I guess you decide what matters to you most. That's actually a good analysis and a good call. Stephanie, thank you very much for doing it. Do you get news? I have to say, I get most, at least, of my breaking news, a term that I hate.
Mm-hmm.
Can't believe I used it. But it is breaking news, generally, from Twitter. Do you, or you're like a cable kind of
gal? I get it on my phone.
You do. Well, that's what
I get news alerts on my phone.
Yeah.
But I'm not big on Twitter or Facebook, I must admit.
What are you making, a political statement
or
something?
No, I'm not making a political statement. It's too much. You know, I get the news alerts on the phone, I get the emails, I get online all the time.
But the hot food bar may disappear. I mean, you got to decide what your priorities are. We only have time for one more quick one. Amy in Cambridge, you're with us at the Boston Public Library. Hi there.
Hi. I'm pretty stuck on the Grenfell Tower fire in London.
As many as 100, they're saying now. Yeah. I'm sure you heard that.
I have, and I was really shocked, actually, that the New York Times, it was more or less buried, at least in their online version. I had to go to the Telegraph to read the latest. Couldn't find much. It's in there in the New York Times, but it's quite buried. And I think it's just, you know, so horrific, especially the backstory about neglecting the building and putting a lot of money into kind of greenwashing it and making it look nice for the wealthy neighbors without putting in sprinklers. I think it's really terrible. Every aspect of it is just terrible. And so that's sort of stuck in my head.
You've made a wise choice, I think. Amy, thank you very much for the call. More pressure on Theresa May, who's got enough pressure because of the snap election.
Well, that's one of the themes over and over, that people had been warning about safety problems there for quite some time, and they'd not been addressed. Anyway, there's a lot of news coming. We can't keep up with it all. But coming up, we're going to talk about some of the news, particularly this Michelle Carter verdict on the teen texting story. The verdict is in. Michelle Carter is guilty. We're going to talk with Emily Rooney about that and a bunch of other stuff. Of course, she's got her famous list of preoccupations and proclamations. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us, as she does every Friday, for her famous list of fixations and fulminations, is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press. Hello there, Emily.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Norm.
We need a mic for
Emily. There you go.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hey there.
Emily, let's start with a verdict that surprised me, actually.
Me too.
In the case of Michelle Carter, she is the one woman who was 17 at the time. She encouraged her then a close friend or boyfriend, some are saying Conrad Roy, to take his own life in a car. Judge Lawrence Moniz said she's guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm shocked by it too, because there was a push that this was just free speech, protected speech, that language itself, you can't be charged with murder over language, but he was using apparently another case in Massachusetts that was precedent for this and didn't even get into the issue of free speech. So, I mean,
but
she did do it. There's no question that
there's
did
no
it.
Question.
In fact, they admitted she did it, that she sent these texts, and she was really quite aggressively pressing him to get back in the car and just do it. And
well, I assume nobody is going to agree that this behavior was anything but grotesque. Yeah. The question is, was it criminal?
Right.
And it seemed to me prior to the decision that what the judge had to decide was that words can be weapons.
Right.
And while part of it was that, my quick reading, and I've literally only read about 90 seconds of this, he not only decided that the words were, there was a causal connection, but he decided based on this Commonwealth case that preexisted this, that was precedent, unlike on the words as weapons, where there's no precedent in this state, that her failure to act, that she had a duty
take
reasonable steps to alleviate the risk. I hadn't heard that at all in the lead up to the decision, that her failure to do that, based on this case from Massachusetts, that in addition to the affirmative stuff is what he decided meant involuntary manslaughter.
Here's a little bit of what the judge said. There is a duty to take reasonable steps to alleviate the risk. The reckless failure can result in a charge of manslaughter, and it did. So she's free on bond still, even though the prosecution wanted her to be taken into custody. So she could get nothing. She could get probation. She could get up to 20 years. My guess is she won't get that much time.
Well, there was a lot of testimony about her very fragile mental state as I guess he was in and out of mental hospitals. She was in and out of mental hospitals.
She was in a mental hospital? I thought she was just in a state where she thought she didn't have any friends and she was seeking...
No, I think she was pretty seriously mentally. She was a cutter, as they say. She was cutting herself frequently, and he had big-time depression problems. Yeah. And so,
but that'll go to sentencing, as you say, probably less so, to, obviously, not to the underlying. But, you know,
and her age, I imagine, will go, because she was 17 at the time.
Yeah.
That will. But
she's not a sympathetic character.
No, obviously she's not a sympathetic character.
No.
Except that she's young. You know, the other interesting thing is, you know, the whole notion is, what is it, tough cases make bad law or whatever that expression is. I was not aware until this case started percolating up maybe a month or so ago. I mean, obviously it started long before this, that we're one, there are 11 states that actually have laws relating to assisting someone in a suicide, which this is. We are not one of them, so I'm guessing the legislature is going to rush to do.
I think it's assisting. There are laws in certain states that make language a liability, so it can be a suicide. It can be other things. That's what that law I think pertains to, as opposed to a law against helping somebody commit suicide. It's really about, can language be a weapon? And that's what other states have
In this case, the language, I mean, obviously the judge decided it was a weapon. I don't know if you use those words, but it was direct.
Yeah.
Let's assume this legislature, which often is fairly careless in how it drafts things, as evidenced by this marijuana embarrassment that they're going through right now. Let's assume that there is legislation that speaks to this that maybe includes, for example, what if you bully someone online, a la the Phoebe Prince
Same
situation?
Thing.
Is that considered the kind of speech that leads to a suicide for which you are criminally
liable?
That's
exactly what they're talking about.
But, I mean, this is a pretty complex thing for these men and women to be deciding.
Maybe we will see some kind of a, you know, change in law here.
I would assume so. I mean, I think we not discuss with you? It was after, I mean, the highest profile example I can think of this is Tim O'Brien, the guy, young, I think he was a teen too, who killed his best friend's mother in summer.
He was 15.
Janet Dowling. Was that her name?
Janet Dowling was her name, yeah.
And stabbed her, what, 100 times?
It was Tim.
It was Tim. It was Tim, I think. But in any case, whoever it was, O'Brien was his last name. The law was changed to lower the age at which you can be tried. Eddie O'Brien, I'm sorry. My apologies. The law was changed to lower the age a juvenile can be charged with an adult crime as a direct result of that. So I'm assuming there's going to be huge pressure on the legislature to do
Tim
something.
O'Brien wrote the book,
Tim, one of my favorite books ever. You ever met him, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen him speak.
Him.
He is
gosh.
Just one of the great books ever written.
Yeah, I agree.
In any case, we're talking to Emily Rooney. And again, we're going to return to this Michelle Carter thing with Dan Small, as I said, former prosecutor, U.S. prosecutor, and former and now a current big-time defense attorney at 12 o'clock. And we will take your calls with Dan as well.
So there's been a lot of press, and the plot has thickened.
It has.
About this Megyn Kelly interview with Alex Jones, the horrible person, I think, that does info. Well, he is.
He's a kook.
He's a horrible person.
Worse than
the most
kook,
horrible
yeah.
thing he has done is claim for ages that Sandy Hook did not happen
when
those little children were murdered in their classroom. Yeah, and he was behind the pizza thing with Hillary Clinton was running a sex
pizza
ring,
gate, right.
and he said, you know, 9/11 was an inside job. He said all this crazy stuff. So what's the latest?
So she interviewed him about, I think, maybe more than a week ago now, because she had the promo ready to go last Sunday night. The minute the promo airs, there's a huge backlash online, backlash from the Sandy Hook, and why are you giving him a forum?
Yeah.
So she responded, I thought, reasonably. I mean, he has been legitimized by Donald Trump himself. Gave him White House press credentials to InfoWars. That's the name of his website.
Think about that for a second. This is the president of the United States that has done something for someone who said Sandy Hook was a hoax.
And he was a big supporter of Donald Trump.
Yes, he was. He'd been on a show.
But let me back up a minute. I mean, Sunday Night with Megyn Kelly is up against 60 Minutes.
Right.
They have made a huge mistake, not by putting her against 60 Minutes, but putting her in a formula situation where Megyn Kelly is like acting like Mike Wallace or something like that.
That's exactly
I think. Horrible. And they've got, you know, the obligatory animal stories, you know, the elephant.
Week, they did the elephant thing, I know.
This show should be all about Megyn Kelly. It should be a live program. It should not be on tape. Nothing should be edited. Have a live interview with. We wouldn't be having this discussion if that was a one-on-one sit-down, much the way the format was for her. That was what made her.
On her Fox News show, you mean? By the way, for the folks who didn't see the first show, two of the three stories, as Emily
is
suggesting.
One was by Josh Mankiewicz, and one was by Cynthia McFadden.
Right, two of the three she wasn't even in. She just threw to them kind of
thing. It's formulaic. David Corvo is a longtime producer for 60 Minutes, and then Dateline, and now this. He has a formula, and he plugged her into it, and it doesn't work.
By the way, we have some sound. What we haven't mentioned, which really causes the plot to thicken, Alex Jones says he not only recorded the phone conversations with Megyn Kelly and himself in setting up the interview, but he also says he has recorded the whole interview, and he is going to release it tonight and prove, or last night, whatever it was.
He released some of it already.
And prove that the edited version that she's going to show Sunday night is
a
fraud.
Bad job,
Here's a little bit of the conversation between the two of them. This is before the interview. Obviously, the first voice is Megyn Kelly's.
I have not enjoyed being in any way on the pointy end of the political spear. You know, it was never anything I wanted to do. And so it's not, you know, I always say that I'm a combination of Mike Wallace, Oprah Winfrey, and Larry the Cable Guy.
I know Larry the Cable Guy. He's a good guy.
I love him. And so, like, that's what you'll get me interviewing. Get, you know, a little bit of all three of those. And hopefully everybody will walk away feeling like they had a good dinner, you know. Nutritious, some red meat with some dessert at the end.
You know, I can relate to that. I often think I'm a combination of FDR, John F. Kennedy, and Adam Sandler.
Right,
I mean, what kind of person says this about herself?
She was giving him a pitch. You know that I can understand. She was selling him the idea.
Well, it's fine.
Fine
if it's a pitch, it's fine if it turns out she takes him to task Sunday night.
Well, here's what – talk about the plot thickening even more. After all this backlash, NBC has admitted – they're going back to the drawing board, have completely re-edited the thing.
I didn't
know
that.
And they're including one of the fathers who lost a child in Sandy Hook. And I think it's in a it's an aftermath. It's like an interview after the fact or something like that. But honestly, you know, it's I don't think this is going to help her. The ratings were – the first week she had Vladimir Putin. The ratings were decent. Last week she lost 42% of that audience. My guess is it's. And by the way, she's up against reruns of 60 Minutes. So it's not even.
By the way,
totally
one of
right.
our colleagues, can I just say for a second, this is a piece that's in the Globe, just an update on Judge Mone's decision, also said the case was not legally novel since, get this, 200 years ago. this is true. I'm reading from the Globe. A state prison inmate was prosecuted for convincing a man facing the death sentence to hang himself in his cell 6 hours before he was to be executed. So, in any case.
But, you know, you were totally right that this is the wrong format.
No, totally
she was very. She was really tough as an interviewer on 60 Minutes. I mean, on Fox News Live.
Yeah, they have her
they
as this
doing.
Plastic anchorette, when really she
is terrific
as a live interviewer.
Yeah, she is.
She's good.
Can we stay on this 1 second? I'm guessing the three of us agree that if she does a responsible job on Sunday night, there's value to having Alex Jones on. You don't think he should be on at all, Mark?
Well, I'm not against it.
I'm not against having him on, but I think nothing seems to hurt him because he basically, in his custody fight with his ex-wife and their divorce, his lawyer got up there and said, he's making all this stuff up. He doesn't believe any of this stuff. He's just a performance artist. And it doesn't seem to impact his popularity with his listeners.
Well, the same thing happened with Donald Trump.
Exactly.
I mean, what's the difference?
You mean people said he was making everything up in his divorce?
No, not his divorce.
Doesn't matter what he says. You said this repeatedly.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about grabbing women's crutches. It didn't matter what he said.
Oh, that was him. I can say in any case. We're talking to Emily Rooney. I'm dying to hear, because you are rather curmudgeon-y.
Yes.
With the fact that starting tonight, but big time tomorrow morning, the tall ships are coming back to Boston. I've spent half the morning saying she either hates it, like with a passion, or she loves it. I don't know.
Do you know?
I would say you like it.
Well, you love race cars, which is sort of a variation.
I do.
Of,
like
you do
race
love
cars.
It.
I love it. And the more chaotic, the better. You know, shut down all the streets, have millions of people. That's why I was in favor of the Olympics. Just bring it on, you know?
But do you like the ships themselves?
I love the ships themselves. I love the whole pageantry of it. I love the fact, you know, if you watch TV, you get a little bit of history lesson on each one of the ships.
Were there 54? Is that what it is?
Yeah, 54 this year. I remember I was a producer the year that Chet and Natalie were anchoring it. Linda, what year was that? I don't know what year it was. It was, oh, my gosh, late 80s, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wow. Anyway,
well, you ever been on one of these ships?
One. No. I've walked on one. I've never actually sailed on one.
I want you to know, you're talking to two people who not only have been on one of the ships, but last time they were here as a promotion for our old radio station.
Worst night of my life.
We slept on
Russian
tall ship. with two listeners. Now, let me just tell you what the best experience was the whole night.
Did you get your own room?
No, we did not.
We slept in the same room with them, actually.
We slept in a dormitory style room. There were a few clothing
Everybody in the same room?
No, here's the best part.
Yes, you're all in the same room.
We were. All of us. Not the young Russian men who were the sailors.
They were like 16-year-old skinny young men.
The highlight for Marjorie is she goes in the bathroom, I guess, late at night to do whatever you do. And there are, what, 20 shirtless, buff, 18-year-old Russian sailors in there. That was
in
her
the bathroom?
In the bathroom.
Hold on. They weren't buff. They were skinny and emaciated in their underpants.
They weren't emaciated.
They were emaciated.
They were in their underpants.
I believe
they
hadn't
You know what the highlight was for me? Because they didn't feed us, and we were told we'd have dinner on the ship for us. And so I go in the, is it called the galley?
Yeah.
I go
galley.
In the galley, and there's not much food. There's bologna. And as I'm eating the bologna, because I'm rather tall, and I guess they hadn't, maybe Russian sailors are not tall, I yelled out to Marjorie that my head is stuck on a fly strip. And so I am literally glued to
Is that true?
Totally true. I am glued, plastered into a fly strip. How many flies
were... It was a night
from hell. How many dead flies were on that strip?
Yeah, you must have had 50 dead flies in the strip and about 15 of them in your head.
That sounds like awful.
It was awful.
One
it
of the
was
worst
like a terror
nights
idea.
Ever.
The Russians...
Terrible idea.
The Russians didn't speak English. We, of course, didn't speak Russian. There was a lot of confusion.
Our listeners thought they were getting a great deal, too.
Ship. These poor people, this couple that came with us, thought, what the hell is this? They won a prize.
Right, they won. This
and
is the winner.
And they're in this room with these fly strips.
So
and
wait, you were, your,
cheese
the ship was already docked.
It was docked, yes.
Because... You know, you can do the. There's a reporter from BC, I think, right now that's on the Esmeralda coming in.
Oh, is
actually,
that so?
Reports have been great. I mean, I would love to be able to do that.
Yeah, well,
anyway, I'm looking
you.
Forward to it.
Looking forward to it. Where
actually,
are you going to watch him
I
from?
Am big time,
well,
too.
I was invited to, you know, a watch party down in Charlestown.
Oh, wonderful. That would be great. So when is the high time to watch them?
Tomorrow morning.
Well, it starts at 9, but I think it doesn't really get going until sort of like midday.
Doesn't get going until they put up the fly strips. That's my position. Okay, so Emily, the reason you're here is not to talk about these things, but for this reason.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
That is correct. So the usual questions, thematic and participatory.
Oh, yeah. Now, listen, this one is definitely participatory.
Okay. We're ready. Excellent. We're ready.
So this is a fill in the blank.
Oh, I love
you
that.
You ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Why not?
And it's all about people.
Okay.
Okay, good.
All right. So that's the theme, fill in the blank, all about people.
Uh-huh.
Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust is...
Gone.
No.
Is gone, and how will we tell the difference?
Is a total enigma.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
I mean...
Okay, we're supposed to characterize them. Okay.
A total enigma.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, because we didn't learn. I mean, well, for example, we had Paul Revel there, who is the Harvard graduate
school. Yeah. She kept a low profile.
He said internally, and this is why I read she did great things, but I don't think she used the bully pulpit of being president of Harvard to the world's...
No, she far less than Neil Rudenstein or, you know...
Well, surely less than Summers.
Yeah,
even
less
though
than
he's
Summers,
controversial.
Right.
Okay, next.
All right, Special Prosecutor Bob Mueller is...
Is going to prevail and is not going to
what
answer.
What does prevail mean?
He's not going to answer back to these attacks on him. I think he's going to be very quiet
Jim?
About it.
Going to indict.
All right, I'm just saying he's a tough cookie.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, he's going to indict.
But can I just say one thing about this? I don't know if I mentioned this on the radio yesterday.
Indict whom?
Frank McNamara, I did say this on the radio yesterday, which could be troubling depending on where leaks are coming from. Frank McNamara, who was appointed by Reagan, former U.S. attorney, told me on Greater Boston the other night that Mueller had been his first assistant, which I didn't know. And he ended by saying, the one thing I guarantee you is there'll be no leaks. We've had two big-time leaks.
Yeah, but they may have been coming from the other people, that Coates and that.
You think
that
Jared Kushner is leaking that he's under investigation?
I don't know, but you know what? I'm sick of people criticizing leaks. Leaks are wonderful.
Okay,
let's move on. I love stories without leaks.
Retired basketball player Dennis Rodman is...
A fabulous ambassador to North Korea.
A disgrace.
An opportunistic jackass.
Yeah,
there's just
that's
no
a little
other
kind.
Way around. You know, he is.
That's what Madonna said, too, by the way.
Did she?
Yeah.
All
you
right.
have to Google that if you don't understand it. Go ahead.
Former Yahoo CEO Marissa Meyer is...
Does she still have the playpen next to her office and Yahoo?
No, she doesn't have an office anymore. Yeah,
she's gone. That's what the end of the thing is, right?
Okay. I'm saying she's a brilliant strategist.
Why?
She walked away with $125 million.
How did Yahoo do on her watch?
I think it did well.
I don't think she has
to worry about her future employment, frankly, with $125 million. But that don't be crazy.
I mean, I love that stuff. No, I love that.
It's usually
the guys who get that kind of a sweetheart deal.
You know
what?
If she was going to have a little playpen next to her office, she should have let the women with babies do something.
You like it when women do it? So do you like it when the CEO of EpiPen, I think it's called Mylan, makes $97 million a year while charging $600 for a pair?
She was overcharging.
You think so?
I don't care about the money.
Okay, fine. How much the medicine in an EpiPen costs?
$695.
$1 is what the medicine costs.
$600. I think he's lowered the price since then. As long as we're on this theme, former GE chairman Jeffrey Immelt is...
By the way,
he just bought a place. I looked it up this morning at 36 Commonwealth. Yeah. What's up with that?
That's so funny that you focused on the same thing because that's my thing. Real estate rich. He paid $7 million for that thing.
And?
Gutted it. I mean, you know, he probably put $2 or $3 million into it. And why move to Boston? You know?
I don't know. And by the way, he's not committing it from what I read this morning that he will stay in Boston now that he's leaving in a few months.
I have no idea.
He loves Boston. I don't know. What's next?
Criminal defense attorney Jonathan Shapiro, who's currently representing Michael McCarthy.
He's going to win his case.
Is?
I think. Of course, I thought Michelle Carter would be not guilty, too. So what do I know? What about you?
He's a very good lawyer.
He's a great lawyer.
I'm just saying, he is a dynamic force.
He's a fabulous lawyer. I mean, he's a great lawyer.
I think he's going to get him off.
So do I. So
I think no one's going to be held responsible.
I think it's likely. What else?
What else? Be quick. All right. One more. Tall Ships coordinator Dusty Rhodes is
legendary. I mean, she really is a major force in this town. No,
she deals like a man. That's
what I like about her.
Yes.
Do you want to give a shout out to your buddy who works with her?
Yeah,
Tony. I saw him the other night.
Did you see him the other night? Yeah,
he's a nervous wreck.
I saw him. No, he seemed relaxed.
Yeah, he's
all right. One more.
One more, quickly.
CBS anchorman Scott Pelley is
getting screwed.
A class act.
He is a class act.
Yeah, I'm going to miss him.
Yeah. Tonight's his last one.
That was a fine list. What are you doing tonight on...
Well, we got to do Megyn Kelly and Alex Jones. And then we're doing a piece that Adam Riley came up with about Howie Carr. So the Boston Herald put Holly Robichaud on hiatus because she represents soon-to-be Senate candidate Jeffrey Deal. You know, so they bumped her column. But Howie Carr, you know, he's got all kinds of connections. He joined Mar-a-Lago. His daughter was an intern for Trump. Anyway, they don't disclose his relationship with Trump.
No, they do not. We're doing a piece on that.
Great. We'll be watching.
All right, you guys. That was
nice
fun.
Nice to see you, Emily. Thank you so much.
Emily Rooney, fill in this sentence, Marjorie.
Emily Rooney is blank. Go ahead, fill it in.
A dynamo.
Oh, ho.
You said.
Sorry, we're out of time. Go ahead.
Oh, you chicken. Emily Rooney joins us every week. You can keep up with her on Friday night, 7 o'clock, Beat the Press, right here on WGBH Channel 2. Up next, Michelle Carter has been found guilty in the texting suicide case. We're going to talk about it with attorney Dan Small. You're listening to Boston Public Radio at the Boston Public Library.
Today at noon on BPR from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, the judge has decided the texting suicide case against Michelle Carter. We'll discuss with you and a former prosecutor turned defense attorney to the stars.
Judd Apatow, the man who gave us Bridesmaids, Knocked Up, Trainwreck, Girls, and so much more on his new movie, plus his upcoming stand-up gig right here at the Wilbur Theater. Boston Globe columnist Shirley Leung will tell us why we might rethink shopping at TJ Maxx and what it means that Amazon is buying Whole Foods. Wow, will Jim soon be banned from the hot bar? Callie Crossley on the Bill Cosby trial and criminal charges against government officials in the Flint, Michigan water debacle. Then our news quiz with the guys from Aeronaut Brewing. They'll tell us all about their best beers plus their new beer garden. Perfect for us because it's right near WGBH Studios in Austin. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio. Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. And because it is Friday, we are here at our studio, WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. As we said to you about a half hour ago, Michelle Carter has been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in the texting suicide case by a juvenile court judge. Here with us for his take on the verdict and the sentencing is Dan Small. Dan's a partner in Holland & Knight's Boston and Miami offices. He was a prosecutor for the U.S. Department of Justice. Then he successfully defended former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and was lead defense counsel for former Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards. You the only lawyer who's ever represented two governors on corruption charges? You are. Is that true?
I think that's right.
Congratulations. Dan, it's great to see you. And by the way, after Dan explains to us what happened, he's going to stick around with us till the bottom of the hour, and we'll take your calls on the ruling. 877-301-8970. Good to see you, Dan.
Good to be here.
So, Dan, I obviously don't know as much about this case as you do. I was surprised. I thought she would be acquitted. She wasn't. She was found guilty. So did the judge reach the right verdict?
I thought the judge did a really good job of walking a very difficult line. Obviously, nobody killed anyone in the murderous sense, but words can kill. And whether you use the example of someone shouting fire in a crowded building and someone getting hurt, or Judge Bowen, the judge used the Bowen case, which is an 1816 case.
Yes.
Where one inmate persuaded the inmate in the next cell to kill himself. So words can kill, but he did a very nice job of walking through and getting to the point where she had persuaded him to try it, he had stopped, and she told him to get back in the truck. And that's what I think tipped it for him, and I think that was the right decision.
You know, two of the things that I learned from having quickly read about this decision, obviously it only came out an hour ago, Dan Small, is one, this Bowen case, whatever you call it, this 200-year-old case, because I was under the impression not only was there no statute, which is true, there was no precedent, apparently it's a 200-year-old precedent, but number two, at least my quick reading of this decision suggests he's not finding her guilty of involuntary manslaughter just for her affirmative acts, which was what we've all been debating for weeks. Is that a weapon? Those words become a weapon. But also for her failure to act, which he, I think, said was reckless and wanton conduct, meaning to stop him in some fashion. That hasn't been discussed at all, at least as far as I've seen. Is he right on that one, too?
Well, it's a mixed bag. What it is what he's saying is her conduct put him in a dangerous situation. And then she didn't do anything to get him. Once she put him in that dangerous situation.
Oh, so
situation,
the predicate is that she put
exactly,
him in.
Exactly.
She not put, had he been in there independently and she known about it but didn't do anything, she'd be guilty of nothing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So what's the difference? She was obviously doing a lot of texting, and I think they had a 40-minute phone call too right before the suicide. But if there were no texting and she were just urging this young man, would that be different?
Urging how? What do you mean?
Urging him to kill himself in the same way she did over texting, but she did it texting as opposed to words. Would that matter? You know, this is a new technology. Well, it's not that new, but you know, the fact that you would be texting someone back and forth like this, as opposed to 15 years ago, you might be just verbally trying to bully someone.
Well, the reason it matters is because it's a record, right?
As opposed you've got to he said, you've got a she cold said. Record, and I mean, it is an extraordinary case in that way because you've got these texts, and the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, when it upheld the indictment, talked about being virtually there,
right?
Virtually present, and that's a new concept, but it's not new to anyone of that age group who live on their texts, and that's how they communicate.
We're going to take your calls in a minute. 877-301-8970.
But I guess what I'm asking you, though, I just want to be clear. If there were a witness there and they were in a room with four people and she had berated, and then, you know, an hour later, is the texting different, I guess, than just the talking?
No, I think that it's different, as Jim said, because it creates
a record.
No uncertainty about
right.
what she was
but
saying.
But if there were witnesses that had
there
seen
witnesses
her do this,
it would be the same thing.
Be the same thing. Okay.
You know, again, we're talking to Dan Small. I'm assuming if history is a guide, and this is not just this legislature, any legislature that has no law covering something like this, we're going to hear this afternoon, we're going to hold hearings, we're going to whatever. They call you as a witness, and they say, we're going to draft some legislation that covers a situation like this. As a defense lawyer in this part of your life, what do you tell them to be careful about so that they don't go too far, if you know what I mean?
Absolutely, and you're right. A number of states have laws that outlaw encouraging or aiding and abetting suicide. And I just think the fact that it's a tough burden in Massachusetts is a good thing. I don't like a law that says it's illegal to encourage someone. I don't even know what the heck that means. And so you are then getting into some very difficult First Amendment and interpretation issues. And I think, if anything, this case shows we're okay. You know, we don't need any more
let
laws.
Judges on an ad hoc basis decide case by case what to do?
Judges do on an ad hoc basis all the time. I mean, they have to interpret the law. Does it reach the point of wanton and reckless conduct which puts someone in danger? And I think it's okay that it's a high standard. That doesn't bother me. I worry about the legislature fixing a problem that doesn't exist.
Okay, so Judge Moniz gets the same case, but instead of Michelle Carter being as direct in her instructions, I don't have the tweet in front of me, hang yourself, jump off a building, do something, there are tons of ways. All she said was, you're a piece of crap. You're worthless. You don't deserve to be on the planet. You serve no useful purpose to anybody. And she did it as relentlessly as she did this. Is she guilty of anything?
There have been several, the other type of case that's similar to this, there have been several bullying cases where people have bullied someone who was vulnerable so much that they killed themselves.
But in most
that's
of those
a very
cases,
tough case to make.
And my understanding and is in most of those cases where there have been convictions, they've been overturned by
that's
higher
right.
courts. Is that not
just
correct?
Just for that reason. Just because words alone, you know, it goes back to the encouraging thing.
Our number is 877-301-8970. A verdict has just been reached, a guilty verdict of involuntary manslaughter in the Michelle Carter case, the young woman who urged her friend, boyfriend, we're not really clear what their relationship was, but to take his own life, and he did take his own life. So you can call in about that. I wanted to ask you, too, you mentioned before we went on the air that some of her actions after the death of Conrad Roy might have contributed, well, I don't know if they contributed, that's my question, that she tried to cover this up, that she tried to ingratiate herself with the family. Did any of those things
matter?
She had
a fundraiser, too. Didn't she have a fundraising baseball game or something?
She had a fundraising baseball game for suicide prevention.
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly.
Just a fundraising baseball game. I think that does go, the judge didn't mention any of that, which is fine. It does go to confirming her motive and that she knew what she was doing. And it answers the question, which you always want to answer, which is why was she doing it? Apparently, she wanted to be the aggrieved girlfriend
right.
and to get that kind of attention. And it puts some rationality into totally irrational actions.
And the other thing is that there was a lot of testimony about his mental health problems and her mental health problems. They were both in and out of mental hospitals. They were both on a lot of medication. She had been cutting herself, those sorts of things. How much does that matter in terms of the sentence, at least?
Well, it'll matter a great deal in terms of the sentence. There's no getting away from the fact this is a terribly sad case all around. I mean, there are no winners here. There are two young people who are both terribly troubled, and one of them managed to essentially take it out on the other one. So it will impact her sentence. This is an act of sickness, I think, as the prosecution said, a sick game that she was playing. But we'll see.
Yeah, we're talking to Dan Small. He's going to stay with us, and we'll stay with you on this topic to the bottom of the hour. And Diane from Fairhaven has pretty much, it appears, the same question I would have asked. So you're on with Dan Small. Diane, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hi. Diane.
And then to your show, first of all.
Thank you very much.
Yes. I'm in Fairhaven. I grew up in Mattapoisett. I also have a lot of experience with mental health issues. And my thought all along was, it's so tragic, and I feel incredibly horrible for the family. However, again, they both had these mental health issues. And, yes, she crossed a huge line. But part of that wanting the attention and all of that, that's, again, part of her issues. And I just feel, I hope that there is some, in the sentencing, there is a component of mental health.
So do I.
She just can't be thrown into a cell and let their, just do. Has to be some sort of enforced mental health. So.
Thank you, Diane. Will there be, Dan Small?
Absolutely. Remember, this is a juvenile court.
The judges are
focused on helping people. As I said, I don't see a long prison sentence. I see an extraordinary effort to do whatever the system can to help a deeply troubled young woman.
Although it's interesting, you think of people that seemed looking at them, you could tell they were mentally ill. I think of John Salvey years ago that shot up the abortion clinics and killed several people there who, had an outburst in right in front of the judge and tipped over the table and everything else. We don't take very kindly to the insanity defense anymore anywhere in the country, do we?
Well, but we're not talking about an insanity defense.
No, I mean, but we're talking about you know, extenuating circumstances when you are mentally ill. It doesn't seem to work in a lot of cases. Well, yeah, I don't really know if it works that well in sentencing.
Well, it doesn't work that well, certainly in the adult system.
Yeah.
But in the juvenile system, they have a lot more flexibility. And clearly, she's a deeply troubled person, although some of her actions, as I said, after the event show a degree of motive and cover-up that is even more troubling in some ways to me.
James, you're in Dedham. You're on Boston Public Radio from the library with Dan Small. Hey there, James.
Hey, thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on the generalizability of the case from the obligation to act when you find out that someone is in potential danger. It makes me think of that whole case that led to the bystander effect, you know, when people do not intervene because they feel somebody else is going to take care of it or deal with it, and there's that very troubling case where a woman was brutalized in a set of apartments and everybody was looking down and...
Kitty
Genovese, yeah. What a Penn State case.
Or Penn State.
Yeah.
Penn State.
Would they all be also, you know, convicted from the same kind of... I mean, it's very interesting. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, for better or worse, the law is generally that you do not have an obligation to help someone unless you put them in that position, unless you created the danger, and then you have an obligation to help them. But there are lots of cases where... No, you don't have an obligation to help. You have an obligation not to do something to make it worse or to hide it or to cover it up, but you generally don't have an obligation to help someone affirmatively.
Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Thanks for your call, James. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's go to Bob in Arlington. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, folks. How are you today?
Fine, good. Thank you.
Well, your guest just answered the second thought I had about obligation, you know, as a citizen to helping out. But before I give you my first point, I'd just love to say, boy, if this is ever a teaching moment for parents and teenagers and electronic usage, this is it.
Well, the lesson is how to treat your fellow human, and it so happens the vehicle for mistreatment was, you know, the implication is if she'd been smart enough to just say it rather than write it, she wouldn't have gotten in trouble, which sadly may be the case. But why are you looking at me?
Yeah, because I'm with Bob more on this.
About
think that people take texting, people abuse that process too easily. It's too easy to be nasty. Well, it's too easy to send out late night tweets or whatever.
A dangerous instrument that people are holding in their hands nowadays. They don't realize the depth of the danger that thing can do.
And just to follow up, one of the reasons I think it was important for the verdict to come down the way it did, is just that teaching moment idea, that there's got to be a message going out that little device in your hand has a lot of power, and it can be used or abused.
Well, you know, now I'm going to agree with both of you because of where I thought you were going, Bob, thanks for the call, is that we talked about anonymity yesterday. This is not quite anonymous. It's impersonal. It's a lot easier to do something in writing and hit send than it is to say it to somebody's face, so you're probably right. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Michael in
the Czech Republic.
Wow. Hi,
we are
Michael.
Huge in the Czech Republic,
we really
Michael.
We are. Yeah.
Thank you for the call. Are you really calling from the Czech Republic?
Yes, I'm really here, and I've been listening to you for at least 4 years, and I love you, and we'll talk about that more later.
Wow, you sound like you're like right next door on Boylston Street.
You're on with Dan Small.
That's thanks to Skype. listen, this idea that words can kill is insane. I think that at the most, this young woman could be found guilty of some kind of negligence that she didn't report this person's precarious mental state to the appropriate authorities or, psychologists, psychiatrists, or whatever. I would blame more this person's parents her, you know, that they got the parents of the man who killed himself, that he could be so precarious that some words could kill him. Come on. We've got to...
Well, he had mental health issues, Michael. Stick around. Don't go away quite yet. What's your reaction to that, Dan?
Well, I hate to disagree with someone who listens to us from the Czech Republic, but you know, the reality is words can kill, and words can be, as I said before, whether it's shouting fire in a crowded building or whatever it is, there's plenty of cases about words that can kill.
Michael, were you saying something? Michael, before you go, who's more popular in Prague, me or Marjorie? Michael, we got to let you go. It's a bad connection.
Yeah,
call us again soon.
It started out great, and then it deteriorated, unfortunately, rather quickly. Tara in Salem, you're on with Dan Small.
Hi, Tara.
And me and Jim. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, my God. I love you guys.
Thanks.
I listen to you almost every day.
Oh, thank you.
I was just going to say that teenagers, they don't understand action and consequences at that point. They're almost like, I've dealt with mental health issues in my family and drug issues, and pretty much if you're an adult drug user, they tell you for a whole year after that, you're not the same. You're like a teenager. You can't make decisions. You don't realize the total end proof of your consequences. So I kind of feel bad on both sides because neither of them really knew what was going to happen, what the other person was going to do. She was probably saying, yeah, go ahead, go kill yourself. And sounds rude, but she probably didn't know that you actually might go and do it. You know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
No, we do know what you mean. Dan, what's your reaction?
No, I agree, and we're all sympathetic, I think. But one of the things, Jim, you were talking about this earlier, that one of the things that texts do is to provide, you know, word for word on cold, clear paper. And those texts, some of them are so direct and cold that some of the sympathy begins to wear off at some point.
Well, as you said at the beginning, and I don't know if this would change your mind at all, Tara, but when he was in the truck with the carbon monoxide, he changed his mind. Didn't he at one point go out and get some ice cream with his family during this weird day and then come back to the to the parking lot?
And she did say, get back in. I mean,
and
that was...
She said, yeah, get back in the truck. Get back in the truck. So that's pretty direct.
Very direct.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
You know, I'm much more worried about the slipper. Again, what this kid did is horrible. There's no question about it. I haven't heard anybody defend it, even those who say it's free speech, which gives me the creeps to some degree. But I do worry about the slippery slope you're not worried about. I mean, what are the next set of words that cause someone to do something horrible to themselves for which a stupid person, young or otherwise, ends up in the can? I mean,
I'm very worried about the slippery slope, which is why I don't think we want a broader statute.
About a narrower statute? I mean, I know you don't want law, but why not a carefully crafted, if that's not oxymoronic when it comes to legislatures, carefully crafted statute that only captures the Michelle Carter situation rather than something...
But this is a unique case. I think this is a very unusual case.
Is cyberbullying unique? No,
cyberbullying is not unique, but what you just finished saying, to tell somebody who's in the process of committing suicide, get back in the truck, is rather unusual. You know, it's not just texting in a bullying way that which you see. We saw that with Phoebe Prince up in Western Massachusetts, where she
We need a law with a high standard, which manslaughter is, and judges to apply it. And if you listen to the judge's decision, right up until the point where she told her to get back in the car, she was going to be a free woman.
That's exactly right.
And that's what the judge said. At that point, the party's over.
By the way, what happened to Melania Trump's campaign against cyberbullying? How's that going?
Well, it hasn't started. It hasn't started yet. But, you know, I think, and Tara was making the point about her being a young woman, which she was. She was 17 at the time. But I thought of these kids that were booted out of Harvard, the freshmen that were booted out of Harvard a couple of weeks ago for these racist, misogynistic postings that cost them their entry into the freshman class.
They're not
class
going to
there.
Jail, though.
Talk about a teachable moment.
They're not going to jail, but it talks about a lot of people were forgiving them because of their age. And, you know, you're 17. You're not 11.
Yeah. We have time to squeeze in one more. Jennifer, you're in JP, Jamaica Plain, and you're on with Dan Small. We're at the Boston Public Library. Hey there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a reporter, and I've covered a number of cases on cyberbullying where young kids, excessively young kids, are relentless in their treatment of people on social media. Specifically, I'm thinking of a case where a girl was 11 years old, and she was a cancer survivor, which left her with some nerve damage and disabilities.
There's a record of what these kids are saying. Is there, are there any ramifications from this case for young kids and cyberbullying?
That's what we started talking about. It's a great question. How about it, Dan Small? Jennifer, thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Jennifer. And it, we, I think we said earlier on, all we can do is hope and pray that it's a teachable moment, that the high profile of the case itself will make an impact on people who take that little device too casually.
You know, before you go, Dan, I think this is a compliment. I'm not sure. When I introduced you before, I said, to my knowledge, you're the only lawyer.
Marjorie, when he says that, I don't know.
No, I think it was. You're the only lawyer in American history, to my knowledge, who has defended two governors accused of corruption. So that's something that puts you on Wikipedia.
Correct.
But beyond that, I am told that at some point you represented my former Central High School fellow alum, Bill Cosby. Is that true?
That's correct.
And what kind of proceeding?
In these defamation proceedings, I represented about a year and a half ago. I was asked to represent his wife, Camille.
Oh, Camille.
In a deposition, and we actually had a deposition here in our office down the street with the TV trucks surrounding the building. And then, as a result of that, she asked me to step in and represent him, which I did for a time.
In this criminal matter?
Not in the criminal, in the civil.
Very quickly, we only have 30 seconds left. Based on what you see, I know you're not in Pennsylvania. You are here. Gridlock jury, as always happens, judge says go back, try harder, etc. What happens here?
Well, they're going to go back.
I know that.
If they've been going this long and they're gridlocked, I think there's a good chance they will end up as a hung jury. And then it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
Meaning if they retry the case.
If the government decides to retry the case or not. This is not a case that's going to get better with age, so... retrying, it's going to be interesting.
He doesn't get better with age either, but that's another thing. In any case, great to see you, Dan Small.
Great
thanks
to be here.
Dan
Small, thank you very much. Dan Small is a partner in Holland & Knight's Boston and Miami office. We appreciate your coming in. Coming up, the writer, director, producer, Judd Apatow. He's got a new movie out. He's also got an upcoming couple of performances at the Wilbur Theater next month. We're going to hear about both up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us online is the writer, director, producer, judge, Judd Apatow. Judd is the man behind the TV shows Freaks and Geeks, Girls, the Larry Sanders Show, the brilliant Larry Sanders Show, and movies like Anchorman and Knocked Up. And of course, though, here in Boston, those works are dwarfed by the gift that he gave us in his epic 1996 comedy, Celtic Pride.
I'm sorry I've been acting like such a jerk, okay? We are right in the middle of the NBA Finals. Know that I tend to get a little bit crazy.
I know. But I've been hearing that for 15 years. In the mid-80s, when the Celtics won the championship, you were a joy to be with. But I can't stand seeing you in a good mood when they win and a bad mood when they lose. I won't let the Celtics run my life.
Well, how do you think I feel?
Mike, these are divorce papers.
Who can forget that? Judd Apatow has a new movie out. It's called The Big Sick. Marjorie and I saw it last night. It is great. He's also returning to his roots as a stand-up comic, which brings him to the Wilbur Theater next month on July 24th. Two shows, 7:30 and 10. All proceeds go to support the Greater Boston After School Arts Fund. Judd, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here. The last time I was here, they were tearing down Boston Garden.
Well, speaking of Boston Garden,
because you're a film, they tore it down.
I got your resume right in front of me, Judd Apatow, and I'm having trouble locating Celtic Pride. Did you delete it from the playlist?
Celtic Pride was 1996, maybe? 1995, and they were about to tear down Boston Garden. They let us shoot there, and then they tore it down. We were the last thing that occurred in Boston Garden.
Wow. I did not know that.
Nor did I.
That's wonderful. Well, tell us about your new movie. We saw it last night. It's a very feel-good kind of, at least it was a feel-good kind of love story to me. Tell us about it.
Well, Kumail Nanjiani, who is one of the stars of Silicon Valley,
yes.
Great show.
Had a very unique story about the beginning of his relationship with his wife, Emily, and they wrote this beautiful movie about it. Some of it is about the fact that he He's this man from Pakistan who moved here when he was 18 years old, and his parents want him to have an arranged marriage, and he falls in love with an American woman. And then early in the relationship, when it's not going well, suddenly she has this mystery illness, and he's forced to hang out with her parents, Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, while trying to find out if she's going to get better or not. And it's based on a true story, and it's very sweet and really hilarious, and I'm excited for people to see it.
You know what was really funny? I love the part. He goes to dinner at his parents' house, and they're all sitting around the table, and they're all from Pakistan, of course. And then in the middle of the dinner, like it seems like six dinners in a row, the doorbell will ring, the mother will say, can't imagine who that could be. And then it's yet another Pakistani young woman that mom is trying to fix him up with. And he's got this, what is he keeps him like in his bureau, all the pictures of these women, right?
Yes. And that's a very real thing is the parents are part of that process of arranging a marriage. And in real life, Kamel felt a lot of pressure to say to your family, I'm not going to do that anymore. I know you did it. And everyone in our family did it, but I'm going to be the first one to not do that. It was terrifying for him, but it's also a really funny situation.
Very funny.
He's forced on all these weird dates.
So here's a little clip from The Big Sick. Kamel Nanjiani confides in his brother Navid in a restaurant. Listen up.
I have to tell you something, babe.
Hey, little.
Yeah. I've been dating this girl.
Asha?
She's white. Oh! I thought you were going to say you were involved in a hit and run or you got caught forging some checks, but a white girl. That's such a cliche.
Okay, we hate terrorists.
Sorry. If I find someone who's as good for me as Fatima is for you, Mom would understand, right? I mean, she wouldn't love me less.
No, she'd definitely love you less.
You know, I've read at least a few articles, Judd, where Kamel has said, this is not a political movie at all. And I nod in agreement. And then I remember Maureen Dowd writing about your takedown of Donald Trump. And I say, well, wait a second. What is it, political or not? So what is it?
Well, you can make a non-political movie and think Donald Trump deserves a takedown. I think that's what the majority of the country thinks. We developed this movie before any of the Trump stuff started. In this new context where there's a lot of talk about immigration, suddenly, there's an aspect of it that is important, which is it humanizes immigrants in our country who are just struggling to be happy and figure their lives out just like everybody else. So I guess that's political. I think it's just human to say, hey, this is how some people live who came here from other countries, and it's just as warm and funny and interesting as your life.
Well, in that clip we just played, when they were whispering about, he's dating a white girl, and they say, we hate terrorists. It's because they're in this little restaurant, I think, right? And everybody's kind of looking at them, these two Pakistani guys with their dark skin and their black hair, and they're looking at them suspiciously. I figured that they wanted to just make it a joke or just warning them that he wasn't. But that's certainly a political thing, because I think you do feel like that if you're Muslim in America now, right?
Well, I definitely think that most people who are not from other countries don't understand what it's like when something terrible happens and suddenly everyone looks at you funny.
Yeah.
And you have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And can you imagine what that's like?
No.
Especially for a comedian who travels around the country and is in all sorts of different communities, when suddenly everyone looks at you weird. When some militia person commits an act of terrorism, it's not like everyone's looking at white people weird. So we don't get that experience. And even, for people like Kamel, who's a celebrity, he says it's something he deals with every day. And I think it's a way to joke about, that part of people's lives that has been the result of the different conflicts that have happened.
Judd Apatow, I saw one of my favorite things is Seinfeld's great, what is it, Comedians in Cars with Coffee or whatever the hell it's called. And you were great. It was a great little episode with the two of you. I hope you're not offended when I say this. It's fair to say after I saw you for 18 minutes, you're a fairly neurotic person. Can I say that or I shouldn't say that?
I don't know who isn't neurotic.
Okay, fine.
Like, are there people who are not neurotic? Like, do you think Mike Pence isn't neurotic?
I think he's probably getting more neurotic every day.
So here's where I'm going with this thing. When you've reached, mediocrity is a nice place to be for some of us because the expectations aren't that high. When you've done, and I mean this seriously, all of the stuff that you've done, so much of which is gold comedy, are you? What's your level of anxiety when something like The Big Sick comes out that it won't live up to the Apatow reputation? Do you worry about that, or you just do what you do?
Well, I would worry about it, you know, during shooting or editing. Usually, as it's coming together in the editing room, you know if it's come out well or not. At this point, people have seen the movie and really love it. So I want a lot of people to see it. I would love it to do well at the box office. But I also know that no matter what happens, it's just going to be around forever now. And sooner or later, everyone will see it, whether they like it or not.
It's a healthy attitude. We're talking to Judd Apatow. His new movie is called The Big Sick.
So we have learned that you are coming to Boston next month to the Wilbur Theater to do some stand-up comedy. So this is something you started doing when you were a kid. It's kind of, what's up with this? I mean, is this just coming back?
Well, I started out as a comic. I did stand-up from the time I was 17 till I was 24. And then I kept getting writing work and that just, you know, pulled me onto another path. And about 3 years ago when I was working on Trainwreck with Amy Schumer, I got the bug again. Yeah, she's so funny. And I would watch her and think, well, why am I just in rooms with editors and by myself writing all the time? I'd like to be among people. And I so love stand-up. So I started doing it again. I was at the Wilbur a few years ago with Amy. We came and did a Trainwreck concert with all the people in the movie who do stand-up. And, you know, the Wilbur is one of the great comedy theaters in the country. When you ask people, what's your favorite place to play? The Wilbur is always one of the first theaters that they talk about. So
yeah.
I'm really excited to get to come back and do two shows. And the second show is a benefit for after-school arts programs in Boston. And so I'm glad that we could do something helpful while we're in town.
I want to return to stand-up in a minute, but since you or Marjorie just mentioned Trainwreck, when I went to see the movie, I was convinced that the LeBron James thing was going to be a disaster. Not that I know anything about movies, except that I thought this guy was so wildly funny and such a natural comic. Were you surprised about how good he was?
I thought it would work, but I don't think I assumed that he would be such a naturally hilarious person. Sometimes you think, oh, I'll get it out of him. I'll figure out how to get him there. But he didn't need any help at all. He came in, he fully understood the joke, the vibe of the joke, because it is a funny, weird idea that LeBron James has no sense of his own success and has this, you know, normal guy best friend, and he doesn't realize that his life is different than his doctor friend's life.
Yeah.
And it's very sweet, and in a lot of ways is what LeBron is like. I mean, he is this legendary guy, but he's surrounded by a lot of the people he went to high school with. They all, you know, work with him, and they're having a blast. They're all really smart and take amazing care of him, and he does the same for them. It was great being around. It really was almost a learning experience about how well you can handle yourself in the world.
We're talking to Judd Apatow. Judd, can we stay on the stand-up thing? I know you were doing this when you were a teenager, and I want to return to Neuroses just for a second, if I can. If you were to say to me, what is the single most terrifying thing one could be asked to do, I would have to say it's be a stand-up comic. And do you not experience that because you were doing it when you were a teenager, or do you experience it? I mean,
experience it when I started. I mean, I would get sick to my stomach for years before shows. And in this latest run of doing stand-up, I certainly was very scared in the beginning. I remember once Marc Maron was in the crowd, and for some reason,
oh my gosh,
him watching me just threw me. It was maybe the most scared I ever got. I don't know why, because he's a friend of mine. I just thought, this guy is judging me right now. But one of the reasons why I do it is to get over stage fright and to get more comfortable. Because stand-up certainly forces you to stand behind what you say, feel comfortable talking with people. It's good for your confidence if you can get over that terror hump to get up there. And it's easier when you have a lot of material and you know it's worked in the past.
So, Jon Apatow, I'm dying to know, because you did direct Amy Schumer in Trainwreck and talked about doing stand-up with her. And of course, you produced Girls and done a lot of interviews with Lena Dunham, who is, and that was a great show, big deal. But I don't know if it got out there to where you are, but there was a kind of a mini controversy here in Massachusetts about Amy Schumer being in the cover of a magazine in a swimsuit. And, you know, she doesn't weigh 75 pounds. And Lena Dunham has also been someone that has been very, I think, transformative in showing her non-typical, you know, model body on television all the time. And I wonder what you think about some of the blowback that both those women have gotten, because they're not, you know, 5'9" and 115 pounds. Both of them have taken some flack. What do you think?
Well, I think that someone should write a paper about people's reaction to people like Lena Dunham and Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
Because it's a real Rorschach test for other people's mental states. You know, when an incredibly smart, creative woman is out there and it troubles you in any way, it says a lot more about your own insecurities and self-confidence. I mean, obviously, beauty comes in every possible form, and it's so unfair to women, you know, that all the images they see are completely unattainable. First of all, a lot of it is CGI. They fix up all these people's faces and bodies, and you could go online and they'll show you the before and afters of how they changed the way people look in photographs using
really?
A computer. And I see it with my kids. I have a 19-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old daughter, and the beauty standard is just ridiculous. And it's hard to convince them that all that really matters is the beauty inside and who you are and your personality and your character. But they see these images. And I love that Lena Dunham and Amy Schumer, who are both beautiful women, are comfortable saying, hey, this is who I am. I'm a normal person. This is what I look like. I think I'm awesome. And I think that helps a lot of young people get the madness of all of these Victoria's Secret images out of their head.
But it must be hard, I bet, to cast a woman who doesn't fit that stereotype in a leading role in a movie. I would think it would be hard to do. You know, you want
It isn't, because they're so funny and they're so creative that there's always a place in storytelling and in movies and on television for brilliant people. It really isn't all about being classically gorgeous, because I think that we're much more interested in the lives of people and the ways they're funny or dramatic. So I never found it difficult to get that done. If the projects are strong, I think people are really into it.
This is the voice of Judge Apatow. He's going to be at the Wilbur on July 24th, 7:30 and 10 o'clock. He has a brand new film out called The Big Sick. I want to play a clip from one of the greatest shows ever, The Larry Sanders Show, written by Judd Apatow. Listen to who's in this clip. Larry, played by Gary Shandling, obviously, is being convinced by his producer, Artie, played by Rip Torn, to make Ellen DeGeneres come out on his show when they walk into Larry's sidekick, Hank, played by Jeffrey Tambor. Just listen to this great clip.
Tried to get her to come out on our show.
Oh, for God's sakes, Letterman tried that. He got nowhere. I'm not going to do it.
So what? Why would she come out on Letterman? Because David obviously has crossed over to the dark side of the force.
Please stop.
Have a nice dinner.
Thank you.
Where are you going dinner with?
I'm going with Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh, really? I like her.
Yeah. I hear she plays on her own team, if you know what I mean.
Yeah?
Really?
Yeah. Well, listen, I believe I know more about homosexuality than you two. Mm-hmm. After all, I'm the one with the gay assistant, and that's why I know she's a donut humper.
Bumper.
That's why I know she's a donut bumper.
All right, see you guys later.
So, he seems to be at the top of the pantheon of comics for the Judd Apatows of the world. Why is he revered by so many of people like you in the industry there, Judd?
I think that Gary Shandling changed television twice with It's Gary Shandling Show, which was on Showtime in the 80s, which really broke the format wide open and showed how experimental and imaginative sitcoms could be. And then with The Larry Sanders Show, he made a show that was satirical and brutally honest. And I think it laid the track for everything that you see in TV comedy right now, from Louis and The Office to Curb Your Enthusiasm. He invented that genre.
And what are you working on now? There's a documentary, yes? Is that what's going on?
Yes, we're doing a documentary for HBO that will be on in March. And it is a really deep look at Gary Shanley's entire life. And he had a fantastic comedic career, but he also was on a spiritual journey and was into Buddhism and had a lot of interesting eras. So we're giving it the full, I keep saying it's like the OJ doc of Gary Shanley.
We're talking to Judd Apatow. The new movie is The Big Sick. You know, I know you're not a big fan of the president. Obviously, we've all read the column, the Maureen Dowd column. But I wonder who you think. There's been an interesting thing going on late night comedy because, of course, Jimmy Fallon was leading in the ratings. Now Stephen Colbert has been catching up some because he's taken on Trump more.
He won the season. Last week they said he won the season.
Who do you think is getting it in terms of late night and the current political climate? You got a favorite?
I don't have a favorite. I'm very impressed by everybody.
Yeah.
Because it's mind-numbing. I'll read the news every day, and I want to climb in the hole and just lay there for a week. So I can't imagine just thinking all this stuff through every day and having to understand every issue and then figure out how to turn it into comedy.
Yeah.
It's a Herculean effort for all these people. I mean, Samantha Bee and Seth Meyers. I mean, everybody is doing some of the best comedic work that's ever been done. I think we're lucky to have them help us process all of this every day. I feel like we're also drowning in just daily corruption and conflict of interest. It's a very sad time to watch so many politicians choose their party over their country. And I'm very nervous about it. I feel like if they do take people's health care away, I think we're going to go through a very dark time in this country. When people realize what they are losing and how they are not being taken care of, I think it's going to be a very unpleasant era for America. I really pray that they do not take away people's health care.
Well, two last things then, speaking of Donald Trump. Had you ever heard of the Emoluments Clause until 3 months ago?
I'm always talking about the Emoluments Clause. I was mad about it with Jimmy Carter's peanut ranch.
That's right.
And last thing is Marjorie Egan, my colleague here, early on, I think she may have broken ground here, was the first one on the air to say she worried that, not beyond the policies, that Donald Trump was unhinged, I think was the expression you first used. Do you?
It's not that I think he's unhinged. I think he lives in a universe of his own creation. And I've met people like that before, where you think to yourself, they're not here with me.
Yeah.
And I feel that about him, that for whatever reason, and I think it's as a result of an enormous amount of mental abuse from his father.
Yeah.
You forget that Donald Trump was sent away to boarding school because they couldn't manage him. They were able to manage all his siblings.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that maybe he just had, education issues or attention deficit issues, and that no one understood them when he was a kid, and they'd probably just yelled at him and sent him off.
You know, Judd, before you go, did you ever see on our colleagues down the hall at WGBH, the Frontline special called The Choice? They do every 4 years about the two candidates.
Yeah.
Did you see the piece they did on Donald Trump? Because they spent a lot of time.
I did.
Wasn't it fabulous? I mean, I thought it was.
It is, and I think it's a Shakespearean story. You have this father who's a slumlord. Mm-hmm. Woody Guthrie's writing songs about what a racist he is. And then you have this son who wants to surpass his dad, so he tries to be even bigger in real estate than him. And what it makes me think about is, that he's so obsessed with talking about winners and losers, but I don't think that that's what life is about. I think life is about love. It's not about winning and losing. It's about taking care of each other. It's about being a good person. And I don't see those values communicated by these people ever. They have a general philosophy, which is, let's get the rich people as rich as possible, and then don't worry, they'll take care of you. They'll find a way to take care of you if you just give them everything. And I just don't think that's how people work. I think when people get richer, they just buy larger ranches.
And by the way, if anybody out there believes in that love thing like Judd does, you might want to see The Big
Sick. Yeah, congratulations.
Good luck,
another
congratulations.
One.
And I have a TV show called Love. So if you like Love, you can watch
my
show, Love.
That's right. That's right. Thank you very much. A pleasure to talk to you, Judd. Thank
Judd,
you very
thanks
much.
Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Great. Take care.
Judd Apatow is a writer, director, producer, comedian. The new film is The Big Sick, and you can catch him himself, Judd Apatow, at the Wilbur Theater next month. There's one July 24th, and he's doing two performances, one at 7:30 and one at 10 o'clock. And the proceeds go to support the Greater Boston After School Arts Fund. Coming up, Jeff Immelt, the man who brought good things to Boston by way of GV. Oops,
GE,
I'm really screwing
too, we
this
call
up.
It.
It's not GE.
I'd do that
I
all over again if I were
GE.
You.
GE. Jeff
exactly.
Immelt, and it's GE. Anyway, he just blew into town, and now it seems like he's blowing out. The Boston Globe's Shirley Young joins for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie and I are broadcasting live at the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, as we do every Tuesday and Friday. So Amazon has just bought Whole Foods, and the burning question I'm sure on the minds of everybody is, what will this mean for my daily foraging at the hot bar? I mean, isn't that... You tweeted it. It's totally
true. Yeah,
that's
what it's all about.
And with Drew Faust stepping down as Harvard's president, the new parlor game, obviously, is who's next. Caroline Kennedy, Mark Zuckerberg, Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama. Joining us for her take on these and other headlines is Boston Globe business columnist and GBH contributor, Shirley Leung. Hey there, Shirley.
Hi.
Well, let's start with Amazon and Whole Foods. Does this mean, well, I mean, you can already buy your stuff online. They have all those delivery things from, you know, the big supermarkets. But what's this going to mean for Whole Foods?
I mean, this is a blockbuster deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it has two big brands. Amazon, you know, the king of e-commerce, meets Whole Foods, which is, you know, upscale grocer, the original upscale grocer. And, you know, Whole Foods has been struggling and under shareholder pressure to deliver better returns. And Amazon really hasn't made, you know, they've been trying to get into groceries, haven't really done well with fresh food. So this solves a problem for both of the companies. And so and also keep in mind, Amazon, they really want to take on Walmart in the retail space. And Walmart dominates groceries in addition to just brick and mortars, you know, selling a little bit of everything. So this also sets up a battle between Amazon and a real battle between Amazon and Walmart.
Well, no one would deny that Jeff Bezos is the genius of all geniuses when it comes to online shopping. Is there any evidence that he understands anything about brick and mortar? We discussed with you a few months ago that he opened a bookstore after basically shutting down virtually every bookstore in America because of the book selling on Amazon. What experience does he have with brick and mortar?
Well, this
food
is why he buys Whole Foods. He's keeping John Mackey, the founder.
Oh, I didn't know that. He is?
Yeah, as I understand it.
The guy who doesn't like Obamacare, but go ahead.
So, you know, I mean, that's the way you do it. I mean, he doesn't purport to know much about bricks and mortar, so here he is. I mean, he's been angling. You know, there were rumors months ago that he was also looking at buying BJ's, which went private. And so so Amazon must have been looking for a grocery partner and to kind of I'm very fascinated on what he's going to do. I mean, Whole Foods, I assume, doesn't really do much online. So what does this mean for Whole Foods getting online? What does this mean for Amazon's ability to deliver foods? I mean, we're a prime customer at home. We order, I would say our biggest retail bill is probably from Amazon. We order a lot of stuff from Amazon. We started ordering household goods from Amazon.
Yeah, me too.
And some groceries. I mean, shelf-stable groceries because it's just so convenient. So
they also have stuff that you don't find at the grocery store. They're kind of these products that are a little bit odd, like
yeah,
dishwasher cleaner, like once a month if you need really heavy-duty cleaning of your dishwasher.
Yeah.
I run around to all these stores looking for it. I couldn't find it. I went on Amazon, and there it was.
Right, you just type search it, and
yes,
you find it, and
yes,
then you click.
Can we get back to me for a second here? Is it my hope out of this purchase is, you know, I closed my eyes when I read about it this morning, when I read your tweet, actually, and I'm saying, can I be sitting on the couch someday and having my own little mini hot bar right in front of me? Is that in my future?
I wonder. You know, they're doing one-hour delivery. Amazon member.
Yep.
And, you know, I remember when the McDonald's CEO came to town and was speaking at the BC CEO College, he talked about delivering French fries. Home delivery.
Well, aren't they doing that in some part of the... I think McDonald's in some parts of the country
are
now...
really hot, though.
So why wouldn't... you know, why couldn't Amazon deliver...
From the hot bar.
Whole Foods hot bar. Right, right.
Yeah, but you also
think... Life-changing.
Life-changing, exactly.
But you also think... I mean, I guess there are a lot of Whole Foods, but they are... their produce is very expensive, and their 365 brand is not, which is great. That's pretty reasonable. But you know, I don't see them battling Walmart, because aren't those two different markets?
Right now they are, but I guess what I'm saying is that Bezos wants to get into the grocery business, and so and Walmart does offer organic, so it's anything, you know, anything that can challenge, you know, Walmart its dominance in grocery. So what's interesting today is that the stock, I think Amazon went up, and then Walmart, everybody else's went down today.
Really?
Yeah, the other grocery chains went down on this news because of it's going to create quite a behemoth.
We're talking to Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe.
Shirley Leung had a great lead on her column about the man whose name I just butchered. I didn't mean to. Jeff Immelt, who is...
Doesn't matter if you get it right anymore.
From GE. Yeah. When you said, Jeff Immelt, we hardly knew ye. So what did you mean by that, Shirley?
Well, so Jeff Immelt is the CEO of, currently the CEO for the next 6 weeks, I think, of GE. And, you know, he will be remembered in Boston and celebrated in Boston for bringing GE, relocating GE from Fairfield, Connecticut to Boston last year. And earlier this week, he announced that he is stepping down August 1st, and he will be replaced by another GE executive, John Flannery, who currently heads GE Healthcare.
You interviewed the new guy.
I did. I sat down with them on Monday, both John Flannery and Jeff Immelt. Flannery is really down to earth, very comfortable skin. He is really, even though he ran healthcare for the past 3 years, that was kind of his first time running.
Isn't that what Immelt did?
Yes, exactly. So he also came from healthcare. Uh-huh. And that was his first time kind of running a quote-unquote industrial unit of GE. Before, he was more management. He spent a lot of time doing private in the capital division, the GE capital division, and he also was in India. He ran the country of India for GE, also in Asia as well. So now he's come back to Boston, and he was funny because I asked him, do you have any role in, because my big question is, what will happen to the Boston headquarters? Will it remain here? Will the new guy suddenly want to uproot and move somewhere else? I mean, they did just break ground on the new headquarters in Fort Point Channel, but it's not done yet.
Didn't you write that he had nothing to do with the Flannery? Had nothing
Flannery
to do with the move.
Said he had nothing to do with the move, but he said if I had a vote, you know, he's like, I would have scribbled in Boston on my ballot, because his parents are from Boston, his grandparents are from Boston. He's
a
Red
Sox
fan.
Oh, he's got a dog, Mookie Betts.
His dog named for Mookie Betts.
Oh my God!
So he likes Boston.
The dog
likes
Boston. You know, the thing that I read your 3 million word piece on Jeff Immelt, however long it was, a couple of months ago.
Yes.
I haven't reread it. I don't remember anything, any hint that he was contemplating.
There was a little hint. He's under a lot of shareholder pressure for about the past year. He'd been there for 16 years. So, I mean, that's a long time for any CEO. And there's been rumors for months, you know, that will he be pushed out?
So why did he buy a $7 million condo? It's 36 Commonwealth Ave.
You know, I did
if
ask.
If he was going to leave town.
This is very funny. I asked, I'm actually working on a profile of John Flannery. And I interviewed Brackett. Is it Denniston? Denniston, I think. He was the retired general counsel of GE. And also he was the former, he worked for Weld, too. He was
His name is very familiar.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
So Brackett, I asked Brackett, because my editors asked the same question. What was up with Jeff Immelt buying that condo in the Back Bay? You know, it must have been a surprise to him. And I asked Brackett this, and he said, Jeff Immelt doesn't rent.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
It's Denniston, by the way.
Denniston. But I guess, I also think about, $8 million is chump change.
But I also wonder, is this good or bad for Boston? Because one of the things, if they're under more shareholder pressure, and that, you know, they were talking about being very philanthropic in the city and all that sort of stuff, and Immelt seemed to be really on board with that. Will this be good or bad for us?
Well, GE has already pledged, I think, is it $50 million? $50 million?
Oh, the Boston Public Schools.
And healthcare over the next 5 years.
About that.
You know, the shareholders generally were happy with the move to Boston. It was an opportunity to change the culture of GE, make it more nimble, more tech-focused, you know, take advantage of our being in the innovation economy here. So, I mean, if you talk to, by many accounts, Flannery, because he came from healthcare and because one of our biggest economic engines is healthcare here, he understands why Boston's a good place to be for GE. I mean, also, he spent a lot of time in the teaching hospitals here, so he's connected to the community here.
Can I add one last thing about this? And I'm surprised, you're not done, you're going to keep writing. I've never met her, but I read about Ann McKee. Is her name McKee?
Klee, sorry. K-L-E-E,
through you,
Klee.
Who seems to have been the person who did virtually everything at this company, including engineering the move, the planning, the whatever thing. Is there any talk about why she was not a natural to take? I mean, and the reason I ask you in particular, not only do you know all these people, but you write eloquently and relentlessly about women not getting positions of power when they're otherwise qualified. Was she in this mix, or we don't know?
She wasn't one. Well, as far as I can, she wasn't one of the finalists. The other finalists were Jeff Bornstein, who is the chief financial officer, who was also given an extra title of vice chairman. There was another executive who ran power, but he actually just announced he was retiring soon because he lost out. And there was another person as well. So Ann Klee was in the mix, but not to take anything away from her. I mean, she's incredibly accomplished and talented. And, I mean, GE is a really big pay. I mean, she ran a unit of I think her unit is, she's in charge of environmental compliance. Mm-hmm. And I think her unit is 2,400 people. Just to give you a sense, Flannery's unit was 18 billion and 55,000 people he oversaw. I mean, so GE
18 billion?
Billion and 55,000. I mean, we'd make it one of the biggest companies.
She in charge of the cleanup of the Housatonic?
She is. I think it falls into her division. So
great column by Yvonne Abraham about that. People should read it.
Yes.
We're talking to Shirley Leung.
Yes, and I'm quite upset by Megan Woolhouse's piece today in the front page of the Boston Globe, because she's saying that TJ Maxx, which is a favorite store for a lot of us to get some good bargains, is not a very compassionate corporate organization there. And by the way, we did just hear wonderful things about them after 9/11 because some of the TJ Maxx workers were on the planes out of Boston. But
we used to work with one of them.
Yes, we did.
One of the women who lost her husband.
Yes, we did. So what is going on with TJ Maxx, please?
So my colleague Meg Woolhouse wrote this terrific piece this morning about TJ Maxx, and it has a great reputation.
It does.
You know, as kind of fighting for the consumer, getting you a great deal on your clothes, and lo and behold, we learned they're under investigation, federal investigation, or they've been warned about, sweatshop-like practices with some of their vendors that they associate with. And I mean, what's interesting about this piece is that you can say, well, they don't control it. They just buy, the merchandise that Macy's can't sell.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And
but
then you learn,
not true.
Yeah, now you learn that TJ Maxx actually, TJX is the full name of the company, also run Marshalls. They actually, 85% of their goods are bought directly from manufacturers. So they actually have responsibility and control and can dictate, working conditions. They have play a role in that. And so the feds were giving them a warning saying, you got to clean this up here. I think there's some terrible conditions for some of your workers, and you need to talk to your vendors. And so I was surprised. And I don't know why I didn't put two and two together, because how else would we have such cheap prices, right?
I figured it was because nobody else wanted them, and they came from these nicer stores, and most of it isn't designer stuff anyway. They have a little designer rack in there, but they do have great bargains. And now I'm like, well, I can't shop there anymore. I guess I can't shop at Marshall's either.
Wait a second. You know, before, is it TJX is the parent of the TJX?
Yeah, THX.
Okay, before you two whap.
Well, I know what you're going to say.
What is he going to say?
Wax poetic about this.
This is the problem.
If you read the Boston Globe where you work, you do this wonderful piece about corporate salaries every year.
Yes.
And a couple of years ago, you did one about how the salaries of the CEOs of major companies here compare to their workers.
Yeah.
Carol Meyerowitz, who's now the former CEO, made $23 million, which is, I guess, fine.
Yeah.
She made $1,100 times the salary of her average person, when most of these other CEOs are making 300 times more, 400, 1,100 times as much as her cashier.
Well, I was going to say, but she also is in retail, so retail have lower salaries. But
maybe you should deal with that, Carol Meyerowitz, out of your $23 million.
But the other point that I thought Meg made in her piece, which
we're
a lot of people don't...
We're moving on from that, obviously.
which she didn't realize was... which I didn't realize was how TJX sells more clothes than Macy's.
I didn't know that either.
And so they have buying power now. Yeah. And so they wield a lot of power in the retail industry. So they could clean this up fairly quickly.
Well, I hope so, because it's a great store, and I like to go there, and you get a lot of great bargains. Yeah. It would be distressing. And not to mention all the stuff they have on the side, like all the hair products and the skin products that are sort of left over from somewhere, and they're all like half price. That's all. That's really fun to get.
So, Shirley, you wrote a piece today that I was cheering for mostly the same reasons. Shirley's piece today is Let's Not Leave Paid Family Leave Up to a Ballot Initiative. Mm-hmm. And the reason, because the timing is great, is the contortions this legislature is doing in an attempt to gut a law that you didn't support, but it is the law. Yeah. The marijuana law is embarrassing as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And as I've said 1,000 times on the show, the lead opponent of the law was Senator Jason Lewis.
Yeah.
Said this week. And when I did a debate at the Kennedy Institute with Jason, as well as Senator Lewis is one of the participants, I heard what he said, and I asked him a question. Could you have drafted a legalization law that you could have voted for? Mm-hmm. And his answer, much to my surprise, was yes. Mm-hmm. Which leads one to conclude that if the legislature had more courage on tough issues, they could do what you suggest, which is spare the public tens of millions of dollars of campaign ads and just do the right thing. So is there any chance they're going to follow your lead on paid family leave, or is it too much business opposition?
No, I think because what's happening with paid family leave, there are trio bills making their way through Beacon Hill right now, and supporters of mandated paid family leave in this state have said if the legislature doesn't act, and they have until the end of next June, they will go to the ballot, and they're going to start collecting signatures in September. They're going to go to the AG in August and start collecting signatures. So basically, even though most of the major business groups oppose the legislation as written, I think they understand that their worst nightmare is a ballot initiative. Because,
like the sick leave thing.
Right, like the sick leave, because it will be very generous, likely very generous, more generous, and so it will be very messy. And also it's very complicated. I mean, how many weeks, 12 weeks versus 16 weeks, who's going to pay for it? Is it employees only? Is it employees and employers together paying for it? So this is a topic you do not want to legislate, make into law by a ballot petition. And I spoke with Jason Lewis, actually happens to be the co-committee chair of workforce and development. And so this, he had to hold a hearing on family leave this
week. Where's he on this?
And so he's a member of the Senate, which voted last year to do paid family leave. So he knows this is a priority of Senate President Rosenberg. He's gathering the business groups that oppose this and the advocates, getting them around the tables. Like, we got to work this out, because none of us, both supporters of paid family leave and opponents of the legislature, none of us want to go to the ballot. So they have a lot of work to do, but I think they're going to get there.
Where's Governor Baker on this?
I don't know where he is. I mean, but I think it's like pay equity. He'll probably take a non-position. He doesn't want to be against it. Who wants to be against paid family leave?
Well, you know who supports paid family leave? That maybe you want to tell these business groups? The President of the United States.
He does.
And in a limited fashion, not as broadly as Hillary Clinton did, but he's, to my knowledge, we've had this discussion, the first Republican candidate for president, not just to mention President of the United States, who actually supported a limited paid family leave.
Well, actually,
so if Trump can do it, I would argue.
As someone who's criticized him a lot, I would say that's wonderful that he's done that. It's wonderful this week. He also said the House health care bill is mean. That was wonderful. And it's wonderful today that he's backing down on shipping out dreamers, yeah. the kids that came here when they were 2 years old yeah. with their parents, and yeah. he was going to get rid of them when he was campaigning. Now he's changed his mind on yeah. that. So those are three good
wait,
things.
Wait, wait, wait. Did you read his tweet this morning before you praise him
what
too
was
much?
His tweet?
I am being investigated for he finally admits he is being investigated yeah. for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI
yeah,
director.
That's,
one of the great tweets yeah. ever, Rod Rosen, whatever the hell his name is,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. So I was as the president of Harvard, Drew Faust, of course, is retired after many years running
11.
Harvard University.
11. Is it 11? Yeah.
Yeah, 11 years.
And I was looking at the people that are possibly going to replace her, and I never heard of any of them. I did hear from the woman from Shirley Ann Jackson from Rensselaer, because she's sort of a big deal, first African-American woman.
She at Rice? Is that where
she's at Rensselaer, Polytechnic okay. Institute. Then I turn the page and I see the names of the Federal Reserve Chair, Janet Yellen, and Barack Obama. So I would assume, I don't think Barack Obama is coming to run Harvard, do you think? But maybe Janet Yellen, I don't know.
I don't know. I was one. I tweeted about this morning. It's like, I think what's interesting is who's not on the list.
Like who?
You know, I was wondering, wouldn't Deval Patrick? You know, I was thinking Deval Patrick
oh,
should be
yeah.
on the list.
Another Harvard guy.
What about Hillary Clinton? Should she be on the list too? She is a Wellesley grad,
yeah.
Yale. But,
yeah.
but that hasn't prevented. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to go to Harvard to run Harvard. But Hillary Clinton could do it. But I don't know if they want a politician. You know, Elizabeth Warren, if she suddenly decides to
she's
give up
Harvard.
On politics.
Yep,
she's
Harvard.
A Harvard law professor. Yep. She, I think, is close, is tight with Drew Faust, so she could do it. But I don't know. It all depends if they want to look for an academic. Like Drew Faust or a politician. And so we'll see. I mean,
you know, I was wondering, it talked about in this piece about how they often go for scholars who've done a lot of research, written a lot of books and stuff. But I'm wondering in this day and age if that's really the way to go. Because you don't think of scholars as necessarily great salespeople for their
right.
schools, great fundraisers, you know, great
yeah.
big personalities.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there are some that are, but you are obsessed with the fact that you think that Drew Faust is basically hidden under a rock for the
no. No, I want to be
there.
Clear. Don't put words in my mouth. Well,
okay,
my position
Jim,
is...
You straighten me out.
Excuse me. Everybody says internally she's done wonderful
yep.
things on diversity by making it more affordable for low-income people and low-income people of color. She's done great things about reorganizing. But my position has been there is no more powerful bully pulpit in the world in education and beyond education mm-hmm. than this. And I don't think she's used it as... widely as she could have and should have. There's a lot of clout in that position. So it isn't like I think she's been under a rock. I think she hasn't done enough outside of Harvard
right.
Square.
And so as a result, I mean, I think she's done a lot internally
yeah,
at Harvard. And so as a result, you could look at the next candidate to balance it out who might look more externally.
Yeah, someone that would have a bigger personality,
exactly.
as I said. So we all know Uber's having a tough time. I have a whole list of everything that Uber's done wrong this year. Travis Kalanick is going to be taking a lesser position, apparently. What's going on over there?
A diminished role at CEO. The board had hired former Attorney General
Eric Holder
to investigate allegations of sexual harassment and a chauvinistic culture. He came out with this report, and they took action. They let go some top executives. Travis is on leave.
Travis? What are you, hanging out with?
She knows him well.
I have met him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can I tell you something? Let me be measured. He is a pig. He is a total pig.
He's a pig.
Is the guy that refers, he used the term boober refer to his... His attractiveness to win. Did you read the memo last week, the sex memo, about what the sex rules were for the conference they were having of their employees in Miami
but you know
in 2013?
You know what's great? I'm looking for the number. I think it was 500,000 that people that get rid of Uber on their phones.
Well, I was going to say, this delete Uber campaign has been quite effective.
It's been quite effective and good for people for
right.
doing that.
My colleague Adam Vaccaro did a piece this morning about you know, the impact on its market share, Uber's market share. I mean, it's still by far the dominant player in ride sharing, but just in Boston... in January, I think Lyft had a 14% market share, and the rest was Uber. Today, Lyft has a 24% market
wow.
share in Boston, and the rest is
That's
Uber.
That's pretty amazing,
so it has had an impact. And the New York Times, one of where the tech columnists wrote a very, effective, very passionate kind of
plea on you know, how do you keep Uber in check? I mean, you vote with your feet, and so
people have,
yeah,
which is kind of neat. And remember how too when the first night of the president's immigration ban, and there were all these massive protests at the airport, and the New York City cabs got together and said, "We're not going to go pick people up at the airport," and the Uber say, "Well, we'll go."
Yeah.
Apparently, that hurt them considerably too. And the sting
it's
from
been
that
a bad year.
Felt.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, and then February. I mean, what started all this? It Holder investigation was the blogger, was the former Uber engineer,
yes.
Susan Fowler,
yep.
I think, who wrote a blog in February. It's been downhill for them. But kudos for the board for taking aggressive action, trying to nip this in the bud, because it's a very valuable company. I mean, one of the it's also a very influential company. I mean, it can...
Well, it's the disruptor of disruptors,
exactly.
Isn't it? I mean,
exactly.
Really,
yeah. So
and by the way, it's only been around... When I read this thing this morning... Was it 9 years? Is it amazing how it went from zero to 100 and beyond so
quickly?
No,
and it's changed so many people's lives.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
You know, it really
it
has.
Did I mention Travis Kalanick is a pig? Did I
you
say
that?
Oh,
that,
I did
Jim.
Say that.
You
I just wanted
that.
To be clear.
Okay, Shirley Young, thank you
nice
very
you,
much.
Thanks for having me.
I like your coat. Shirley Young joins us every week.
Next
She's a business columnist for the Boston Globe and a WGBH contributor. Thank you,
See
Shirley.
You, Shirley.
Coming up, how the shooting in Virginia... exposed white privilege. Callie Crossey joins for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We are live from our GBH, our wonderful GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us on the is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And my powers of deduction, which actually are fairly strong, lead me to conclude that would be Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Nice to see you.
Okay, Callie Crossley, I'm glad I finally get to quiz you extensively about the most exciting story of the week.
I knew you wanted to.
You went to see Wonder Woman.
That's right.
And who was next to you in the theater?
Your boyfriend, Tom
My boyfriend.
Brady.
That's right. Okay, now where was he sitting with Giselle,
He
right?
was sitting with Giselle behind me in the section of the Superlux I would normally be in, but I ordered my tickets late. So I'm sitting there, and I say to my friend, "That's Giselle. I would never recognize him. You know, I don't care about him." And, and I said, because she had on a lovely sundress, and her hair was down. So she looked very Giselle-like.
Oh, yeah.
So I said, "That's Giselle." And I said, "Oh, I guess that's Tom Brady."
So hold on. So they were behind you. So that means you couldn't move your seats to have a better view of them?
I didn't want to see them. The
you
point
didn't?
Of Superlux is to let your feet up and order your cocktail. I'm sorry.
Oh,
you've missed the
God.
Point.
Oh, my God. I would have tried. I would have begged.
Yeah. A lot of the servers were all excited.
Were they all excited?
They were excited. And he was very gracious at the end. When we got up and turned, he was signing autographs and talking. And,
he
you know,
was?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's going to be kind of a pain in the neck, though, I suppose. I mean, it's wonderful that you're a famous guy and he's done so well, but it must be tough to go. Every place you go, people are hounding you for autographs.
I suppose that's true, but let's just face it. There's not hundreds of people at the Superlux.
Is this the one in Brookline?
This is in Chestnut Hill.
Chestnut Hill.
Right.
What do you think? What's your review overall?
Oh, of Wonder Woman?
No, of the Superlux.
Oh, I go to Superlux all the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So the cocktails are good? Food's
oh,
good?
Oh, my God. Excellent.
Really?
Yeah.
And you put your feet up and you sit right there at the table.
There you go.
I should go there sometime.
Oh, it's
broaden
fabulous.
My horizon. What do you think of Wonder Woman?
Oh, Wonder Woman was fabulous, too.
Yeah.
Really good. And,
yeah.
And the next one is going to be set in the United States. You know, it's so
what
satisfying.
Next one being a sequel?
Yeah, it's already signed up.
Already
got.
That.
Oh yeah,
massive
yeah.
Hit.
Yeah. So first of all, you know, woman director, and glad that she's getting all the props that she got, because I'm sure she didn't get all the money she wanted initially. This thing has blown up in terms of both money and as a friend of mine pointed out, who's looks at these kinds of things, there wasn't really that much paid advertisement for it. This was really a word of mouth.
Yeah, it was.
A woman can't wait to see it kind of thing. And that propelled it because, you know, the guys, I guess, thought, yeah, whatever. But, you know, it was huge.
Now, one more thing before we move off this topic. You know, Tom and Giselle advertise all this weird food. You know, they have all this kumquats and stuff like that.
That's not her, by the way. That is TB12.
Well, TB12, he markets that food, but she has this very strict
diet
regimen in the house for them and the children.
I wonder what they ate at Superlux.
Well, What kind of a reporter are you? Do they have buttered popcorn?
Of course they do.
I mean, did they eat it?
No way.
I don't know.
He would never. He's not eating that.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. They have buttered popcorn and they have,
mozzarella,
you know,
sticks?
Oh, no, hon. We're talking pasta and, you know, entrees. You can have a burger. You can have, you know, Parmesan frites, truffle fries. You know, it's really serious.
Okay, so you don't know what they
eat. I don't know what they eat. I guess he could have gotten a salad.
I would have been back and forth to that bathroom like 15 times during that movie. That's all I could say.
You know, you have to care. And I really don't care.
Okay,
we're talking to Kelly Cross.
The wrong person was at that movie.
Sorry.
Kelly, if I don't move on, we won't move on. I know. That's pretty obvious.
I knew Marjorie was excited.
I'm excited. Yeah.
Here with us at 12 o'clock to analyze the decision in the Michelle Carter case was a guy, a lawyer in town, who we didn't know till earlier today in his prior legal life last year, represented Camille Cosby in a deposition and actually represented her husband, Bill Cosby, which, again, I was not aware Dan Small had done that. The jury, I think, is in its fifth day of deliberations. They've told the judge that they were deadlocked.
Mm-hmm.
And can you hear me, you guys?
Mine just went
something,
out. Yeah, I just lost just mine, but mine. I don't know.
Oh,
I think
it's back.
Yeah, mine's kind of weird. Now I think mine's...
So why don't you talk?
Everyone but Jim. So okay. I'll ask Callie Crossley.
Okay.
So the jury in the Bill Cosby case is deadlocked. What do you make of it?
I can't make of it. I'm so surprised.
Yeah, I'm surprised as well.
I'm dying to know what point is, you know, has everybody in a tizzy inside. They've virtually asked for every piece of big information. They've asked to, you know, look at the letters again, talk about, you know, all the stuff that was instrumental really for both sides. So you really can't make anything from what they ask for. It seems like they are seriously relitigating the case inside.
Well, you know, I wonder if it's the Bill O'Reilly defense where, you know, Bill O'Reilly said that these women only came after him because he was a famous guy on television, rich and stuff, and they knew they could get a lot of money from him. You wonder if that's working in the Bill Cosby case, too, where people are thinking to themselves, these women, you know, this is what we say a lot about sexual assault.
Yeah.
If they made it up because he's a rich guy, they want to get a lot of money.
Well, it seems to me that she would have, you know, gone a little harder and stronger if that was her whole being.
Oh, I don't think it is. I believe every one of these women
that's what
say.
I'm saying. So I'm responding to.
Yeah.
If that is your defense, that everybody wants you because you're rich and powerful, she could have gone about doing that in a way that would have enriched her, certainly.
Yeah.
If for one thing, she could have gone to him and said, I'll blow this, so what are you going to pay me? And that would have been the end of it. Why go through all of this? Why stand your ground? Why come back after he broke the rules and started talking about it, which allowed her to open this up again? Why put yourself out there? This, after all, I don't need to tell you, Marjorie or Jim, is not something people want you to keep on discussing.
Right.
You know, this is something you're trying to deal with in your life and you'd like to move on.
You know,
so.
We have no idea. I know you said this. How many holdouts there are on a jury? Well, first of all, we don't even know which direction the holdouts are in. Maybe 11 people want to acquit him, and only one person wants to convict him. But I have to say, the decision I still don't understand, nor have I read a good analysis of. The defense, the prosecution, if I recall, wanted, what was it, as many as 12 women to? Did they want not 12 women who were also victims, alleged victims?
Yes.
I guess you have to say of Cosby to testify. And the judge said it was too prejudicial. He'd allow one.
Right.
I understand the notion about there's a certain volume where it does get prejudicial. One is not nearly as much as two. And if you understand
what I mean. Yes.
Because, you know, the woman who was his victim in this case, allegedly, again, I'm sorry to have to say it, is one. This other woman is just two. It seems to me that the judge really hamstrung the prosecution by not allowing maybe three, maybe 12 is too much, so that you were able to see, assuming you believe the woman's testimony if you're on the jury, that this is a pattern. This is not an aberrational behavior of America's dad or whatever the hell he was.
I couldn't agree with you more, but I'm going to guess that he counted her mother as one of those, which I think is unfair in this. So it looks like she has, you know, two people because her mother was
on
a
the
part
phone
of
calls
this.
And heard
right,
the, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, that's how I'm looking at it. I couldn't agree with you more. And I want to refer back to the Anita Hill case. If you've read the investigative book by former publisher of the New York Times. I'm blanking on her name right now. And the investigative reporter, who's fabulous, who's, I'm blanking on her name, Jane Meyer. You know, the strange case of Clarence Thomas.
Right.
There were, you know,
women.
They were lined up in Washington, ready to testify, and got turned around.
Well,
and so there you go. And they had strong cases.
This happens. You know? This happened as well in the William Kennedy Smith rape case, where there were other women that he had assaulted following the exact same pattern. But I don't know if the law is different in the Cosby case, but in those cases, it was not you had to convict the person on the charges which they were facing against this particular plaintiff, and that was the problem. You can't.
Well, wait, but that's the case in every trial.
Right.
The issue was, do additional witnesses who help establish a trend, Do they provide a helpful and legal addition to the prosecution's case, or do they rise to the level of prejudicial?
Well, I think they
That's
do.
Not a statutory yes. issue. That's an issue for the judge.
Right.
And the judge here decided to limit it to one other victim.
All I'm saying is that I've seen a lot of these cases where nobody gets to come in.
Yeah. Who did the thing? Was it the New York? Was it New York Magazine that did the incredible thing with photographs? Was it all 58
women? No, it was
women?
New York Magazine.
New York, yeah.
Yes, New York Magazine. Yes.
The photographs and a short description
sitting
of the
situation.
Sitting in
the chair, on the chairs on the front of the magazine, and even the empty chairs for women who told them privately but would not, you know, expose themselves publicly.
You know, the one good thing out of this, if I can say, I didn't see it, but I was listening to the, I think it was NPR this morning, was talking about a tweet that the woman who's accusing Cosby in this case, there was a tweet last night or this morning, shortly after the jury said it was deadlocked, that its words suggest that she is in it for the long haul, meaning that if there's a hung jury and the a mistrial is declared, that she would tell the prosecutors, "I'm ready to go through this torture again because I want a different."
Did you see the video that she posted?
No, I
didn't. She posted a video and she dunked a basketball in the hallway, and the cut line was "Always follow through."
Oh, that's what it was. Actually, I take it back. That's what it was. Yeah, I had not seen that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the better front, speaking of legal things, I was about to say, even though none of us are lawyers. And then I realized, oops.
Yes, you're a lawyer.
Well, I'm not much of a lawyer. So 2.5 of us are not lawyers.
Okay.
I have to say, I was so heartened by this decision to prosecute some very high public officials in the Flint, Michigan situation.
Yep.
Because we all three of us have discussed a million times how the CEOs, the top government officials, they always escape. And
that's
if anybody is ever indicted, it's the mid-level or low-level guy or woman.
This is a criminal
that's charges against the head of public.
Involuntary manslaughter.
Yep.
It's the head of the state's health department. So he's a pretty high-up guy in the state of Michigan. And he's one of the five officials that covered this thing up. And,
involuntary manslaughter is what these guys are charged with again.
And, you know, they were talking about this elderly gentleman that got Legionnaire's disease from the water that he knew about. And they quote one of these indictees, this Mr. Lyon fellow, is saying about the Legionnaire's outbreak, which he did not reveal. At one point, documents allege, he said, referring to this elderly man that died, quote, "He can't save everyone," unquote, and, quote, "Everyone has to die of something."
Something, yeah.
And he knew.
That's leadership in Flint. Yeah.
There you go. I am so glad that people could actually go to jail over this.
Well, there's a couple things to mention here, that the governor is still supporting these people that have been accused, saying, Governor Snyder, and lots of folks have been calling for him to resign for some time.
Well, he may be indicted himself.
Well,
I mean, it's not over.
That is correct. The other thing to note is that people who think that this is over, the folks there still have to pay for the contaminated water and are still only able to drink bottled water. They tell them the filtered water is okay, but as many of them have responded, they said, "Well, you drink it."
You know, the one thing
that's
in this New York Times story about the indictments of these five people, including a couple of very high-ranking people, that I'm so glad we're reminded of in every one of the stories about this, a device that costs $200 a day would have prevented all of this poisoning. $200 a day. But you know the attitude out there is that, you know, it's them.
Yeah.
And we're not going to spend the $200. It is just, it's one of the most grotesque cases, and I really hope the prosecutors are successful here.
I do too.
Well, that's not nearly as important a story, of course, as the McDonald's in France.
Well, because she's a foodie.
Selling burgers with two sides, as in a knife and a fork.
That's amazing.
We were discussing this earlier today, and you do have a bun with the burger.
Yeah, what's the point of the roll?
Yeah, well, you know, I've used a knife and a fork with a burger when I've taken the bun off.
Yeah, okay.
But if you
that's a whole different deal,
yeah,
right?
Then you're doing something else. But if you're having it with the bun, I don't understand
Unless you know, when it's so juicy and chock full of stuff that you bite on one side and kind of the fillings come out on the other side.
You know what it may be? Yeah. It may be because I know the French are so fond of our president. It's maybe because he eats KFC with a knife and fork decided they do. Maybe that's the explanation.
I thought he ate it with a knife and fork because it was hot. Maybe? No?
I don't know.
I haven't spoken to him lately.
But let's be clear that this is only with the brand's most expensive burgers only in France at this point.
Yeah. So, I would be surprised if I saw anybody in the parking lot or on the picnic tables at McDonald's eating a burger with a knife and fork.
So, Callie Crossley, under the radar, happens to be on Father's Day.
Yes.
I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yes, I'm very much aware of it.
I had a feeling you might be. What are you doing this Sunday?
Well, I just can't say enough about my segment about fathers.
And I didn't even know you were doing one.
Yes.
Great.
We're doing a segment about the changing role of fathers.
Great.
And looking at the social science research that's been done, a lot of it here. Some so forward-thinking. I have three guys that are fantastic. Ray Levy of the Fatherhood Project, Charles Daniels, and CEO and founder of Fathers Uplift, by the way, the only one of its kind in the country, and also Dr. Michael Yogman, who has been studying this for many years. So many things came out I knew nothing about. So, you know, once and for all, it has been determined that fathers have a unique relationship in the way they bond with their children. And by the way, if they're not there, the damage to the child is long-term and in many large and small ways. I did not know, perhaps you did, that men get postpartum depression. It expresses itself in different ways from women. This is fundamental information that will make a whole difference in how people get to understand how fathers bond with their children. I mean, I was just sitting there just with my mind blown about all the stuff that they said so passionately.
Can't wait to hear.
And, you know, supporting, you and I have talked about fatherhood a lot.
Oh, yes, we have.
I've missed my dad
don't
so much.
Don't, Marjorie.
No,
yeah. Marjorie,
gets
don't.
Out of
don't
line.
Ruin this.
Jim gets out of line.
I know, this is so important. It's so important. I miss my dad,
well.
Who is, you know, just the greatest. They're talking about all the stuff that some fathers can't do or trying to learn to do. And I just remember my dad, and he did everything for us.
That's
you know,
great.
And it's just, so anyway, I hope everybody listens to it. It's fabulous. I just can't say enough about it.
Terrific. We'll be listening.
Well, to all the dads
Callie,
out there,
yes.
Happy Father's Day.
Absolutely.
Okay, Callie Crossley, thank you very much. Callie joins us.
By the way, thanks for resisting your usual impulse whenever we discuss fathers. By the way, she's starting to get angry mail about alleging that my father went to jail.
Oh, dear.
And three to five.
He did what?
3 to 5.
He didn't do 3 to 5 because he didn't go to jail. He did not. He was disbarred. I try to correct this all the time. He was disbarred, and he deserved to be.
Well, let me just say
but he
say
did
that
not go to jail.
If he had, we do discuss the impact of father absence. So there you go.
Yeah, I'll be listening. Okay. Callie, it's great to see you. Take care.
Callie Crossley joins us every week. You can keep up with her, of course, Sunday nights right here at 6 o'clock on 89.7 for Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And she's also with Emily Rooney most Friday nights at 7 o'clock on Beat the Press. Thank you very much, Callie. Coming up, a sudsy news quiz with the guys behind Aeronaut Brewing. They're next on 89.7 WGBH. Ooh, look at all that beer. Boston Public Radio broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bredesen. She's Marjorie Egan. We are live from the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library and surrounded by beer. Joining us for our Friday news quiz are Jason McCool and Ben Holmes. Ben Holmes, the co-founder of Aeronaut Brewery. Jason McCool is arts and culture liaison. Wow, for Aeronaut. Starting July 7th, they'll be opening their beer garden in Lower Alston near us Friday nights and Wednesday nights. Jason and Ben, it's great to meet you both. How are you guys?
Hey, we're great. It's so great. I'm such a rabid listener of the show.
You are?
To you guys every day.
Oh, yes.
So it's quite an honor to be on.
How come Ben's not saying anything?
He's pouring beer.
That's right.
So say something good about the show, Ben, even if you've never heard it.
Oh, man, I love this show.
I know. Do you have any idea who we are? You don't have any idea, right?
Dude, the jugglers, and I...
Oh, yes,
they said
very
that they
good.
They were very visually interesting, and I'm mostly shaggy.
Yeah.
we're wearing the same T-shirt.
That was totally unplanned. Yeah.
Great to see you both, gentlemen.
So tell us about your deal, selfishly, the deal that's going to be close to us over at WGBH Studios. What's going to be happening over on Western Avenue?
Oh, gee whiz. Can I give it a shot, Jason?
Absolutely, Ben.
Yeah,
so there's sort of a long-standing and beautiful Harvard-sparked initiative called Zone 3, which is kind of activating that corridor along Western Ave, which is close to Harvard Street. We know it because we wander across the bridge, that beautiful bridge from Cambridge. Mm-hmm. But what Aeronaut is doing there really is creating a series of outdoor open community events, which are designed to showcase both the sort of cultural community aspects of everything from the Museum of Science to the CDC to different kinds of LGBT book clubs, all kinds of stuff, in front of a canvas of beautiful music created by some of the finest emerging performers in the entire region, and some people visiting us from as far away as Great Britain, Canada, Tennessee.
Didn't you do something last night that you were kind enough to invite us that we couldn't do? What'd you do last night, Jason?
I was at the Boston Talks last night.
Was there not an event last night?
We were on Wednesday. Yes,
that's Wednesday.
We had our public opening on Wednesday, so we had a whole bunch of people there. We had a great time.
And so what's the thinking? I mean, obviously you're creating more than a beer deal. I mean, what's the whole concept behind what you're doing?
Don't we call it a beer garden?
It is exactly a beer garden.
To what end?
Beautiful phrase.
To be a community kind of deal?
Yeah, community is our biggest word. We love that word at Aeronaut. If you've ever been to our tap room in Somerville, we have nightly events that feature some of the most sort of compelling events and cultural things that are happening in Boston. We are so fortunate to be in this rich arts community, and it's my job to sort of advocate for that kind of stuff.
So can I be crass for a second?
Please.
Is this because this is really what you first and foremost believe in, or at least in part because you think it'll help you sell more beer?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes and.
Yes and yes.
Yes, fine. To both.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, people love beer. They love being out in the sunshine. They love free music. All of our events out there are free.
Come on over, Ben, yes.
So we are...
We're being handed a flight. Is that not the correct thing? Hold it from the bottom.
Hopefully not spill it on the computer.
Got it. Thank you very much.
This is beautiful.
Typically, we recommend spilling it on your computer.
Yes.
This is beautiful.
I've certainly done it.
Look at, Jim, the spelling.
What do you mean, the spelling?
Well, it spells out Aeronaut.
Oh, my
goodness. And if you look at the logo here.
Yes.
So what do you see when you look at it? Probably doesn't come over on the air
as well. It's a beer thing.
It's a beer opener.
What was that thing called?
It's also
tab.
It's a beer tab, but it's also a hot air balloon flying in the air. And
it
if you visit us in Somerville, you see all the balloons and the lawn chairs hanging in the ceiling.
Okay, so what are we drinking first, please? Let's drink the one with the little tab thing on it. They all have tabs on.
No, we have to start with A.
Okay,
Jim.
Excuse me. What are we drinking? And then we got to start the quiz. What is it?
This would be the Robot Crush. It's a Pilsner that actually won the Great American Beer Festival gold medal for all American and international Pilsners.
Oh my God.
I have to write that down. Tell me again.
Don't tell her again.
You can see this fella, the metaphor of the artwork here is this robot is a robot who has fallen in love with crushing things.
Of course.
It's a robot crush.
Okay.
Who designs your cans, by the way? Your cans are great looking.
We do it with this awesome local illustrator named Raul Gonzalez. I design every single one of them. Him and I sit down and we start telling a story. Which actually relates to the second beer. Try this. Have a sniff of this.
Okay.
It's lovely, man. This beer
is called
3 Years with Dr. Nandu. And actually, every year we've released this kind of magically named beer. And every year we use the artwork on it to tell some kind of a different story of the things that have transpired over the past 365 days.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
Whoa, what's the story? What's the story you're telling at this particular time?
Oh, gee whiz.
Exactly. Okay, next question, Marjorie. Go ahead.
Well,
I was going to ask you a question. I have never been a beer drinker, but when I drink beer like this, this is not like the beer that I would drink if I went to the liquor store and get a six-pack. I mean, it tastes so much better and so different. So what are you doing?
Well, that is the story of the past 365 days. You see, because in the case of this beer is actually one that involves only a single kind of hop and a single kind of grain. It's what we call a smash beer. And so what we've been doing over the past 365 days is understanding the yeast that makes beer and actually beginning to learn more about certain scientific processes which cause yeast to work in tandem with the ingredients of the beer, and so you can have only one kind of hop and very carefully control the conditions of fermentation, much like a cider or a kombucha or sourdough bread, and really get these extraordinary, exquisite flavors. In this case, I would say from this one hop is really a lot of passion fruit. We get a lot of that.
It was delicious.
And it's just people. Wonderful.
That's right.
And
I'm
shout
a passionate
out to our Aeronaut Labs.
I can't, wait. But I'm very passionate about it, Jim. I'll say that right
before
now.
Before we start this quiz, Jason McCool, I know you've heard this 500 times. It's one of the great times, words, names of all time. What does it mean to be the arts and cultural liaison for a beer joint?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean?
Well, so it's my job to go out in the community and develop relationships with fantastic artists and thinkers, musicians, theater. I come from a theater and music background myself. We have so many incredible events that happen. We have live music 5 or 6 nights a week, and it's always free. We've seen immersive Shakespeare. We've seen pop-up dance performances. So we are not your typical brewery. You never know what you're going to get
food,
when you come
too,
in the door.
Right?
We have food vendors that come in on a nightly basis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a big deal to people, too.
Okay, can we start this quiz while we're drinking, and then you'll tell us, Ben, what the third beer is. Marjorie, who are you going to ask first? Jason closer to me or Ben closer to you?
I've lost my quiz. Oh, here's my quiz. Okay, I'll start with Ben. Ready, Ben?
But no.
Well, good.
He's tweeting something.
Ben's tweeting. Okay, then I'll start with Jason. How about you, Jason? President Trump isn't the only one making attacks on Twitter. Here is Jimmy Fallon.
A former spokesperson for President tweeted that Trump should stop talking because he's heading towards a perjury trap. Trump heard that and was like, perjury trap? That's my favorite Lindsay Lohan movie. I mean, I've seen it like 300 times.
It's a hard one.
It is a hard one. Who told Trump to stop speaking?
Oh, wow.
This tweeting, probably.
This is a president?
Well, if you can identify
this is a hard
the
one.
President for whom the person worked, we'll take it.
Was it for Putin?
No.
No, that's a
wrong
good
country,
one. No.
That's great.
A good one.
Wait a second. Is that what you told him to say, Ben?
He wanted to steal the question.
You can steal the question now. Who is it? He was a president in this country. Exactly.
A president in this country?
Yes, this is the United States, Ben. Who would that be? That narrows it down to 44 other possibles, and most of them are dead.
Exactly. I'm going to go with Bush.
Yes.
Oh. Very good.
Bing, bing, bing. Wow. Talk about
very
it.
Good.
Yes.
I thought Putin was a pretty good answer.
Yeah,
it's
wrong, though.
It
okay,
wrong.
Before you tell us about
that's
the third beer, Ben, this is your own question. The president clearly does not have a stiff upper lip. Here it is.
It's been reported that President Trump is so worried about that he is postponing his upcoming trip to England. He's postponing his trip to England, yeah. Trump's also worried he doesn't have time to learn the language.
That's pretty good. What is keeping Donald Trump from going to England there, Ben?
This would have to be former FBI Director Bob Mueller.
That's an excellent answer. That's wrong. Now, Jason, you can tie this baby up. What is he worried about that is causing him to... He's not saying this, but this is what's going on. To not go to England.
And is this not connected to the Russia investigation?
No.
No, actually, it's not.
It's not.
The impending impeachment trials? Or
No, they're not. It's no impeachment trial. That is wrong. It would be the threat of protest.
The threat of protest.
And by the way, speaking of that, that's an interesting point. I saw that you... Ben, I think you're quoted in some publication. You hosted a debate at your place in Somerville, right? The Clinton, whatever, a watch party? Mm-hmm. So you did, but you said it was apolitical. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So that means you will or will not be covering the impeachment hearings.
Yes. We'll be broadcasting those, and we expect them to be very, very successful.
Fine, thank you. Okay, good. Good. No, it's apolitical.
You need a lot of beer, those.
Okay, the score at the end of one round is you were leading by a massive 1-0. What's the third beer before we go to the next round, please?
Well, the beer we're drinking right now, another thing about the last year is... We built a beer which is called Hop Hoppin' Away. That's number 3. Ooh. That's sort of a light session beer made with these cool, tasty Citra hops. And then it's going to relate to the fourth beer, which I'll tell you about later. But this is a beer that was built with a technique for cold brewing, essentially cold steeping, really funky, hard-to-get hops that was built by our brewmaster. He actually is a PhD analytical chemist. In 15 years, he was developing medical devices and technology.
By the way, the compliment for you guys, she's not being totally honest, that'd be Marjorie. She's not a beer drinker at all,
not just a little bit.
And I'm watching your face. You're loving
Because it tastes so much fresher. And the citrus
taste. These were canned yesterday.
Is that okay?
No, they were not. Is that true?
Seriously.
So that really. So if I, where do I have to go to buy this? Can I go to a liquor store? Do I need to come to Somerville, or can I go to Western Avenue?
Mostly, the place to go is the brewery.
It's Somerville.
Yeah, we have some lovely distributors we work with, but they don't get it all over the place.
Yep.
So we really These four cans right now are freshly available, canned yesterday in our brewery. They'll be gone pretty soon as well.
Okay, that's Ben Holmes, the co-founder who just screwed all the distributors.
But that's,
now,
but
the second
that's a
round,
big deal, though, right?
And it is what it is.
That they were just canned yesterday. That's a big deal in how they taste. They didn't come from, like,
fresh,
California
exactly.
or something
Absolutely
on a truck
fresh.
For, okay, like, 2 weeks.
Okay, ask your question. Will you please,
okay,
Jason?
I lost my place here.
Thank you.
Okay, here we go, Jason. This basketball team, opted out of a visit to see President Trump.
After winning the NBA championship, this is a big story, the unanimously decided to skip the traditional visit to the White House. They're skipping it, yeah. Yeah, after hearing this, Melania Trump said, wait, you can do that?
That's a pretty good line. Wow. Okay. I didn't know this, by
That's
the way.
That's brutal.
I didn't either.
Go ahead.
All right, I got nothing but net on this one. This will
okay.
be the Golden State Warriors.
Whoa,
Golden
very nicely
State Warriors,
done.
Very good. I didn't know the Golden State Warriors.
I didn't know
down.
It either.
Wow.
It's 1-1 there. Ben, you can take the lead co-founder
I'll
of
do my best.
Aeronaut. But one of the president's first executive actions just can't get off the ground.
Today, a federal appeals court ruled against President Trump's and... And get this, they even quoted his tweets in their decision. Or as Trump put it, that counts as a retweet.
Okay, what did the federal appeals court rule against there, Ben?
I think that the correct word for it is a travel ban.
That is the Cap technical box. Term, correct.
Very good. Very
2 to
good.
1 at the end of 2 rounds. So what's the fourth beer there, Ben?
Oh.
You were going to tell
this
us.
This beer is called Double Hop Hop.
Of course it is.
The previous one was called... Hop Hop and Away.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's called Double Hop Hop.
And what distinguishes it?
Twice as much of everything.
Oh, I guess that's why you call it that. Right? Does that mean it's twice as alcoholic?
Yes.
Oh,
this beer is 8.4% alcohol by volume, reading off the situation on the can here. And actually, the artwork, it has two sides to
the
this fella.
The artwork is great.
So the fella in this
rabbit.
Artwork has, yeah, he. This is really supposed to be his evil double on this side and his... friendly self on this side, and it explores the concept. This is like we kind of scratched this on a can with pen because uh-huh. we wanted to see how we liked it and then do the next round. But this is going to explore the quest of him to kind of fight off his arch nemesis.
Yes, there's a whole narrative, yeah. We work with awesome designers, artists.
You certainly
on the farm,
do.
So, yeah.
Those cans are unbelievable. They're great. So
they're series.
Where are you in Somerville, by the way? Where are you?
We are very close to the Market Basket where I once met you in the milk aisle.
We did in the milk aisle? Did I talk to you?
You did. You certainly did.
Thank God. That would have been horrible. Okay, let's squeeze in one more round of question before the bonus round, Marjorie. Go ahead.
Okay, here you go, Jason. Uber could use a real lift this week after another series of shakeups.
That he is taking a leave of absence from the company, but he'll be back in 3 minutes. No, wait, now, hold on, now it's saying 5 minutes. 6, oh no.
Who took a leave of absence from Uber this
that
week?
Would be Travis Kalanick.
Yes, he did.
Ding,
yes,
ding,
he
ding.
Did.
Okay, here it goes. Year. Last question of the regular round. It seems that nothing, I repeat, nothing is safe from Donald Trump's criticism. Here would be Jimmy Kimmel.
The president had an interesting lunch yesterday with Republican senators where he had some surprisingly strong criticism of the he called the bill mean, cold-hearted, and a son of a bitch. Which he knows
oh,
Bill's
no.
a piece of legislation and not a person named. He does know this is not Bill Cosby or Bill O'Reilly, right?
What bill did Donald Trump call mean? This is true, just the other day.
Geez, yeah, I believe that this is the health care bill.
Ding, ding, dang. Very
Isn't that
nicely
incredible?
Done.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, by the way, there's so much craft beer in this community, which is great for beer drinkers like me, and I am a beer drinker, unlike Marjorie. Is there, you guys worry about oversaturation, Ben, starting with you? Do you or no?
Well, we don't. We're a brewery which is driven by a culture of community. So our beer is better every month and every year. And so we have so many explorations to work on that we don't have the time to worry about that kind of thing.
Huh.
But it is also true that it's becoming, maybe this is my monopolistic desire speaking here.
Go ahead.
It's
go
becoming
ahead.
Harder to start a brew, so I wouldn't recommend it.
Just okay. All right.
No, that's a joke as well. It's a wonderful way to pursue your life's ambitions.
Let me ask you another question from someone who knows nothing about beer. Is it better when you go to get a beer out of the tap?
Yes.
It is.
I'm sorry. I mean, I know these are cans. You don't think, you're smiling at me like, don't say that. I mean, there's a freshness thing coming out of the tap. Is there not? Ben.
All right. Well, I started my life as a scientist.
Were you an MIT kid or something? Yeah.
And proud dropout of that.
Actually, beautiful.
I was thrown out.
Beautiful. It's even better.
I dropped out without telling anyone, which really helped. But I'm going to just briefly say that oxygen kills beer.
Oh.
And cans are impermeable to oxygen.
Ooh.
Oh.
Bottles are not. Hmm. Bottles have these little rubber gaskets. But cans are little kegs. And so when you enjoy a can that's been kept cold like a keg would have been, it's every bit as good, especially if it was canned the day before. Frequently, cans are gotten through faster than kegs, and they're never kept open and drank from for a long period of time.
Was this guy ready for that question? Okay, Ben Holmes and Jason McCool, here's the bonus round. Since we're joined by the co-founder and a leader of Aeronaut Brewing, our bonus round will revolve around two original Aeronauts, Wilbur and Orville Wright, the inventors of the Wright Flyer, which is, you know, took flight in 1903. You ready?
Yep.
Switch now, order here. First one's for Ben, Margaret.
These are multiple choice questions. They're kind of off the wall, so you may get them wrong, but don't worry. Everybody does. Okay, here we go. The Wright brothers dated their fascination with flight to an early event from their childhoods. What was that event? A, the gift of a small helicopter toy from their father.
Mm-hmm.
B, the purchase of a pet bird named Birdie. Or C, Donald Trump's grandfather, Frederick Trump's immigration to the United States in 1885, which they sense would eventually lead to a desire for flights out of the country.
I'd go with C myself, but go ahead. So
that's
what is
pretty
it?
Brutal. This poor guy. He deserves it.
What is it?
I got to go with B because a helicopter is so different from an airplane.
That'd be wrong.
You know,
dang.
I thought the same thing. Cause did they even have helicopters?
Well, Marjorie,
they
had planes airplanes? Would have come first.
You just
exactly.
listen to the judges. So what's the answer, Jason?
Well, it's definitely A then.
Bing, bing,
yeah,
bing.
Yeah, right.
Judges, is it tie? Is it actually tie? Is that correct? Judges left.
How can you have helicopters before
judges,
you have airplanes?
Judges still here. How the hell do I know, Marjorie?
Yeah. Why don't you look into that, Jim?
I will. Fine.
Doesn't
is
sound,
it tie?
Doesn't sound right.
3-2, who's winning? Thank you. We don't care who's winning. Somebody is winning 3-2. Now, Jason, are you with me or what?
Yeah, I'm with you, Jim.
You were the arts and something liaison. Mm-hmm. Do you know that?
I do
just want to make sure you remember that. Okay, there were many unusual things about the Wright brothers. Which of these is not true? You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not true. A, neither received a high school diploma. Ben, you can relate to that, I'm sure. B, neither brother ever entertained the possibility of selling the Wright Flyer to Amazon. Or C, both brothers were divorced. Which is it?
I'm going to go with C.
That is correct. Let's leave it at that. That's correct.
Okay. Yeah.
One last question.
They never got married. That's why.
Okay, let's say it's tied because the judges have lost a count. So if you get this right, Ben, you win. And if you get it wrong, I don't know what happens, okay?
Okay.
So give them the question, will you please?
Okay, here we go. The Wright Flyer never flew again after that initial flight.
That's
it did,
correct.
However, take another big journey in another form.
That's right.
How? A, canvas from the plane was made into a one-of-a-kind American flag. B, pieces of the plane, flew to the moon in 1969. Or C, the plane was used as firewood at Mar-a-Lago.
What is it? This is for all the marbles, as they say they've been.
I think all the fires are made out of plastic at Mar-a-Lago. And I would have to go with A, because it was certainly a canvasy kind of rig.
It's very sad.
No, I'm sorry.
I'd say, Jason, you are the winner if you can get this right. What
I'm
is the answer?
I'm going to go with straight to the moon with this.
Bing, bing, bing. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's pretty cool that they did that.
Isn't
that neat?
Gentlemen, pleasure to meet you. Thank you for the beer.
Oh, my
it's
goodness.
Fabulous. And good luck with your venture down the street from
us
in Austin.
I am coming over to Somerville. I'll tell you that. I'm coming over to Somerville very soon.
Great.
Jason McCool and Ben Holmes. By the way, on Western Avenue, be able to buy this beer there, too?
Absolutely.
Okay. Jason McCool and Ben Holmes are with Aeronaut Brewing. Ben Holmes is co-founder of Aeronaut Brewing. Jason McCool is arts and cultural liaison for Aeronaut. Starting July 7th, they'll be opening their beer garden in Lower Austin Friday nights and Wednesday nights right next to us, Jim.
We got that right, yes?
We're already open on Wednesdays.
Oh, you
are? Already open on Wednesdays.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for telling us.
To learn more about it, go to aeronautbrewing.com. That's AERONAUT. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio.
Thank you, guys.
On Monday, we get Charlie Sennett with Global Affairs, our political roundup, Irene Monroe and Emmett Price for All Revved Up. Don't forget to vote on the Jim and Marjorie Face-Off, part of our digital pledge drive. Go to wgbh.org/vote to do
vote
that.
For
I want
me,
to thank the crew.
Thank you.
actually vote for me.
Thank
Chelsea
you.
Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Time's Bedford, up. Jason Teresky, Molly Boycon, Christine Vienni, our engineer, John the Claw Parker.
Thank you
so much
all for coming,
in.
By the way. We appreciate
it. Have a great
weekend.
See you Monday.
See you Monday. Bye.
Thank you.